Bridgewater State University is proud to sponsor this conversation from Boston Public Radio. More at bridgew.edu/gradclass.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, conservatives triggered by anti-racist teachings that claim the military is now too woke. But at a defense hearing yesterday, a top Pentagon official pushed back on those assertions from GOP lawmakers and defended the military's desire to be open-minded and situationally aware of the nation it's trying to defend. NBC political director Chuck Todd will join us to discuss this, an apparent deal on infrastructure, and more.
Governor Charlie Baker wants the state's tax-free weekend to look more like a tax-free summer. He's proposed expanding the traditional weekend to cover August and September, citing a bigger-than-expected surplus. But as the state economy still recovers from COVID-era restrictions, lawmakers are imploring him to use that surplus in other ways. We'll get your thoughts on the sales tax expansion before the governor joins us, ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Yeek, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GPH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. The governor will be with us shortly after 12, but first, joining us to fuel our growing angst about the state of the nation is Chuck Todd. Chuck is the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That's Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Good morning, Chuck Todd.
Well, good morning, guys.
Hey, Chuck Todd.
Happy to be the preview for the governor. How about that?
I know. We're very happy to have you,
the
though, to start. Yeah. Just exactly. Well, some could say the other way around. I'm not sure you are.
Well, whatever.
A nationally famous guy, Chuck Todd. But in any case, before we get to
tell
that,
Charlie Baker, that we don't bite. He's afraid of Sunday morning television. Tell him we don't bite. I mean, I just
whoa.
Hold on.
Has he turned down your invitations?
He has turned down my invitation numerous times.
That will be our first question, Chuck Todd.
Hold on. Does he give you a reason why?
They just choose not to. Some governors don't want to do national.
Yeah.
I get it. I'm not going to sit here and critique it. They have their own reasons not to do it. This was particularly acute with, I think, Republicans who didn't necessarily, Larry Hogan and Mike DeWine would. Charlie Baker less so. And I think that that's just everybody is their own has their own view on that. Not I get it. Not everybody wants to be a national figure, and I don't begrudge it. I just lament it.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear from the governor.
Well, you hear Baker saying that all the time, that he's worried about Massachusetts and he's not going to talk much about national politics.
By the way, it's been good politics for him. It's been good politics for him.
Yeah, he's a very, very popular guy, and we're going to have
that's
him
right.
here at noon, and we'll ask him.
Yeah.
About that. But before we get to, let's move on to what we wanted to talk to you about. A lot of us are wondering what's going to happen with this infrastructure bill. Are we going to wind up with something that's a lot smaller than what Joe Biden initially talked about? And if so, to get a deal, what's going to be gone?
Well, look, I think that the White House wants this deal. All right. It was pretty clear to me in my reporting last week that the White House felt like there was nothing in this deal they didn't like. It just wasn't as big as they wanted, right? But they also believe they have a second bite at the apple. And they want to create a functioning, Joe Biden campaigned on creating basically a functioning relationship again with the other side if it was possible. And you know what? If you can get them to sign on to about 30% of your spending agenda on infrastructure, fine. That's the Joe Biden mindset, right? And I'm going to tackle the other 70% in other ways, and I'll see what I can do. I don't think he gets all of that 70% if he gets this. I think he gets, a chunk of it, not as much as Bernie's asking for, but he will get a chunk of it. But, it's funny. I in the introduction, you sort of gave a hint of sort of the consternation of the national environment. Joe Biden is doing just fine. And I think the public likes how Joe Biden is managing Washington. I think the partisans in each party don't like certain things, but it is interesting to see Joe Biden ran on saying he would do these things. And so far he's been attempting to deliver on that promise of doing a couple things, right? Turning down the temperature. And I think he has made boring great again. and to at least establish conversations with the other side on voting rights. It looks it looks horrendous, right? But when you look at it from the other perspective, police reform looks possible. There's some agreement on infrastructure. You know what I mean? There is something to the normalcy aspect of the Washington storyline that Biden has returned us to.
Well, you know, but let me, while the, as you call them, the partisans, the most progressive Democrats have been very critical of Biden for not being out there enough on voting rights and beating the drums constantly. I have another concern. It seems to me if a third of a loaf or 40% of a loaf on infrastructure is agreed to, the most significant part of that is not what's lost in the on the infrastructure front, Chuck, at least to me, but that it completely fuels the argument of the Joe Manchins of the Democratic Party that we don't need to eliminate the filibuster on anything, because when we're relentless and work hard with the best of our allies across the aisle, we can cut a deal that even the president likes, as evidenced by the infrastructure deal. Is that not a concern?
Well, if you don't like the filibuster, then it's a concern. I also think it's what gives Manchin and Sinema leverage to get this deal completed with the 11 Republicans. Mm. I think those Republicans are afraid that if they don't do this deal with Manchin and Sinema, then they have a harder time sticking to their guns on the filibuster. So this is one of those cases where I think everybody has an incentive to make this deal work, because nobody's quite ready to blow up the Senate yet. And I'm sorry, Sinema pointed this out. There are unintended consequences if you pursue this, if you pursue this path.
We're talking to Chuck Todd, moderator of Meet the Press. So, Chuck, this Arizona hand count that's been going on for quite some time now, the presidential 2020 ballots, is ending today. I believe it's supposed to end today anyway. We're going to get the results a little bit later. But I presume they're going to announce that President Trump, or former President Trump, won Arizona. And I've been reading a lot about this. There's being a big buildup that could wind up in more violence. I mean, what's going to happen if they announce he won?
Nothing actually happens. I don't know if they're going to be able to announce that. I just don't think it's, you know, I'll be curious to see how they would explain that. But there's no, you know, put it this way. Had they found evidence that Trump won, do you think they'd hold it back? I mean, I've found this to be sort of, if there had actually been evidence that they found that Trump had won, we'd have already known. So I actually look at it, it's pretty clear they don't have any evidence to prove that he won, but they'll try to prove that he could have won, right? That he, you know, had this not happened, or had this not happened, had they not counted these votes, it's possible. But I dismiss this whole thing. We know what it is. It's a partisan stunt by people who have no idea what they're doing. But I do think if they had actually found anything that was actually believable that would have indicated some shenanigans, they'd have been screaming it from the rooftops already. But there's no there. They've never found the there. So I don't know how the propaganda right-wing media handles this. And I do think that this is the danger that their elected Republican Party has created by not denouncing the fact that Trump refuses to concede the election. I mean, he is intentionally trying to destroy the democracy, hard stop. And I think that perhaps, you know, look, if this ends up in violence, the blood is on the hands of every elected Republican who refuses to condemn President Trump's behavior. So I will tell you that. I do think the blood is on the hands of these elected Republicans that appeased former President Trump.
Well, blood was on their hands from January 6th, and it doesn't seem to trouble them terribly much. And when you say, where's the evidence, if they had the evidence, that implies that they need evidence. I mean, this is almost like a Saturday Night Live skit. And then you read the Washington Post story the other day that not only is the only reporter allowed to cover it, is whatever that woman's name is from One America Network, but that she's raising
for it.
Right, she's paying. She's raising money for the damn thing.
I've never pursued journalism that way. I've had my expenses not covered, but I've never actually paid for a story.
So, Chuck, I'm serious. Why can't they, in 2 weeks, whoever is running, I don't even know who's running this, for this quote audit, Why can't they just stand up in 2 weeks with zero evidence and say, we've continued our count, we found tons of ballots that were sent in from China, we found tons of other ballots that, whatever, fill in the blank, and as a result, the winner of Arizona, we conclude, was Donald Trump, and to use your term, full stop. We're not providing any evidence. We never provided any transparency during the process. Trump won, period. Why can't they do that?
Well, they could, but I actually think that, the way great right wing propaganda works, though, is not on declarative. It's on innuendo, right? So I fully expect an innuendo announcement, which is, here's the thing. We don't know. We couldn't find this. They got rid of this. I think it's going to be filled with innuendo. Well, you know, they wouldn't give us access to this, or these ballots were somehow missing, or we couldn't find the evidence of this, or they wouldn't tell us this. Remember how the propagandist works, you know, the Tucker Carlson propaganda machine works, right? You're right about facts be damned, but you never make a declarative because the declaratives are too easy to disprove. What you create is innuendo. So that's why I fully expect them to go with the innuendo route, which means, oh, we'll never know the answer, right? Because you actually make people believe the possibility of fraud more if you don't provide any evidence. I mean, it's sick how the human mind sometimes works on conspiracies. But, you know, I do think that the more successful propagandists, you know, I mean, this is the Russian practice. It's never about the evidence you have. It's about the evidence you don't.
Well, that's comforting. Hey, can we go back to the first part of our discussion here? I want to about this deal and the filibuster and what were you intimating a second ago, Chuck Todd, that you think there may be some room for compromise on voting rights, on guns, on policing, on all that stuff? Or did I misread you?
I'm not going in all those routes. I think police reform is, you know, put it this way. We have this infrastructure deal that is somewhere between 25% and 35% of what the president wants. But on the hardcore infrastructure, one would agree, like Bernie Sanders said on my show Sunday, he's like, there's nothing in there I don't like. Yeah. Like, he liked the spending portion. He just wanted more of it, right? Like, but he didn't dispute. He's like, no, I like all those things. I don't like how they are paying for it, or I don't like that part of it. But he did say, so the spending part is going to be generally agreed to, which is why I think if you want a deal, you can get a deal. I mean, the Republicans are getting the best of both worlds here, right? They're going to get credit for supporting some infrastructure without having to raise taxes, and then the Democrats have to do the dirty work of taxes and reconciliation to pay for this, which frankly won't be unpopular with the public. Like raising the corporate tax rate to 25% isn't, you know, it's going to make, you know, a bunch of lobbyists upset, but that's it. Like, you know, the regular public isn't going to be like, oh, punish the, you know, that isn't going to, you know, the people that were already voting on the tax issue already have picked the party they're voting for, right? That isn't a persuadable group of people. But I do think you're seeing some, and what I say, it's a bare minimum of this quote of these people working across the aisle. But look, that China bill, you know, a colleague of mine pointed out this morning on one of our morning calls, you know, had Obama gotten this China bill in the second term, it would have been his biggest accomplishment in the second term. That's how significant that bill is, right? Now, we just roll our eyes about it because we're so focused. And this is where I think cable news and social media mislead the Democratic base sometimes, right? There was so much fire and brimstone about H.R. 1 and voting rights. And by the way, and very, very important, but there is this sort of dismissiveness on the other side of what Biden promised to do, which was to sort of make Washington normal again.
Yeah, I don't know if it's normal again or getting maybe it is. You've been there. Maybe closer to normal. But look.
I was just going to say less perverted. How about this? Less perverted.
Okay.
I think that can be agreed upon.
Well, Chuck Todd, you know, we talk about normal and not normal.
I'm a compromiser, see? I can bring people together. I'm bringing Jim and Marjorie together.
Well, when you look at Joint Chief Chairman Mark Milley, he's in Congress yesterday. He takes offense at remarks from Representative Matt Gaetz from Florida. He's the one that's under investigation for having solicited sex with underage girls. We don't know where that investigation, maybe you know about where that investigation is headed. It seems to have
It's if an indictment doesn't happen by the end of July, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's it.
Our sources seem to indicate.
But in any case, Matt Gaetz is going after the general about critical race theory in the military, and Milley really kind of pushed back and called it offensive to be asked that. What'd you
Milley
make?
Is I've spent some time with Milley, and like the other joint chiefs I've spent time with, you don't get to that job without being an intellect.
Yeah.
Okay. And he really is an intellect. The guy's a voracious reader. He's, you know, I'll tell you this. No stain more than the fact that he was appointed by Trump. And I think he has been trying to sort of erase that tattoo, right, on his resume as best as he possibly can. I think he's doing a pretty good job of potentially winning over the trust of Biden. I think comments like he made against Gaetz, which to me just he's so wonderfully pushed back on it. And I hope Ron DeSantis was listening because, you know, the governor of Florida has this idea that universities should have an open mind, but your education in primary or secondary should have a closed mind. And it's one of these things that's like, it is so bass awkward. See, I did, that was NPR.
Beautifully done. Thank you for that.
It's just, you know, intellectually insulting, right? What Governor DeSantis is creating down there in Florida. It was nice to see somebody in a position like General Milley to give it was very helpful to have a man in uniform use the intellectual argument.
Yes.
Okay, but
you know what I mean, it was powerful.
On a much lower rent close, we only have a minute left. To indict or not to indict, that is the question. Does Gaetz go or does he not? I know he's one of your favorites. Does he go?
Look, I think that this guy Greenberg did a lot of bad things in Seminole County, ripped off a lot of people. He cut a deal. You don't cut that deal unless he's got something. So I would be surprised if he's not indicted.
We'll save that.
Okay.
Chuck Todd, pleasure.
In my regards to the governor.
We will.
Absolutely give you a
ride. See if we can get him for you.
Yeah.
And I mean it. I don't mean it. I don't want it to come across. I'm not being some cable news hack here. Like, you know, I mean it. Like, you know, we don't bite.
No.
And America should know the Massachusetts governor. They're always impressed with Massachusetts governors, DNR alike.
Yep.
And
he's an impressive guy. No question about it. And lots of people are crazy about him. Anyway, Chuck Todd, thank you very much.
See you, Chuck.
Bye, guys.
Chuck Todd joins us every week. He's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That's Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Coming up, we're taking your calls, asking you, before Governor Baker comes, about his proposal to expand the two-day sales tax-free holiday to 2 months. Is this good for box stores, bad for small businesses? Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Governor Baker, who'll be here at noon, by the way, wants to expand the state's two-day sales tax-free holiday. Did I get that right? Sales tax-free holiday. That's right, Jim. 2 months. That's because, he says, Massachusetts is set to end the fiscal year with a budget surplus. That's factually accurate. The state's rainy day fund has more than $4 billion, I think. On top of that, the state's getting $5 billion from the feds. So why not use this as an opportunity to support ma-and-pop businesses and consumers along the way, the governor argues. Baker filed legislation yesterday to make August and September tax-free holidays. State legislature's already pushing back. Some Democrats are saying it will make more sense to use those sales tax dollars. I think the governor said it was $900 million worth to fund housing, education, transit. The head of the Retailers of Massachusetts Association says Baker's move is an incentive that will help the Main Street economy. So now it's your turn. We'll take your calls asking which side are you on? Will this help small businesses or simply drive people to the big box stores? Is it a political stunt or a sincere economic stimulus? The number is 877-301-8970. Business owners, we would love to hear from you. Would-be shoppers, is 2 months of sales tax-free shopping the kind of financial break after this year-long nightmare that you need? 877-301-8970. So?
Okay. Well, you go first, Jim.
Well, you're always in favor of it, and I'm always against it. So we've had this discussion.
Nothing has changed. Are you changing?
Well, a tad. I mean, so, really? Well, wait a second. So you're saying that you continue to support this even those 2 months.
I get what they're saying. We could, you know, put more money toward the T and schools and bridges and all that kind of stuff. But you know what? This has been an awful, horrible, tragic year and a half, whatever it's been. You know, a lot of us could use a new washer dryer, Jim, or use a new refrigerator. Can't spend the money on cars and boats and anything above $2,500.
That's correct.
But you don't have to go to a big box store either. You can go to a smaller appliance place.
You can.
And I just think it's one of those kind of fun things that, oh, we don't get a tax. We don't have to pay taxes on this. We don't have to drive to New Hampshire. As someone I know may have done and bought a refrigerator and brought it back to the state of Massachusetts.
You did that?
No, Jim. Somebody else did that.
I did not do that. I did that. I mean, are you – by the way
– you were seen coming over the state line.
No, I was not. I mean, here we go again. Let me just say this. It's not true. And how would you know if it was true?
Put it on the top of your car, Jim. You were spotted.
Historically, Marjorie
People
is right.
Recognize
I've
you.
Always opposed this. My contention is saving 6 cents on a dollar. I mean, people – if you used to – remember those display ads you used to see in the newspaper and they're now online?
Uh-huh.
40% off, you say, well, maybe I'll wait till it's 50% off. 6% off is not much. It's not going to cause someone to buy something they wouldn't otherwise buy. However, to prove that I am not the most rigid person on the planet, which many people think I am, I actually am willing to split the baby.
Really?
I ordinarily, I'd say invest the money. I think 2 months is too much. I think $900 million is too much. I think a halfway makes sense. Use some of this surplus, maybe half of that $900 million that would go to the sales tax holiday or some figure to do further investment in things that have suffered.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if it makes people feel good, I don't believe it has the economic impact that you and the governor does. But even if it doesn't, if it'll get people feeling better, if it'll get a little more business in this focus period of these businesses, my attitude is they would get the business anyway. They just get it at a different time. It's a special moment in history, and I'm actually partially supportive of this, which I've never been before.
You were someone who I can't recall when you ever told me if I said, oh, Jim, nice new shirt. Well, you didn't tell me
how much it cost.
How much it cost.
Exactly.
So you were obsessed with getting small bargains, Jim.
No, large bargains, please.
Well, how much of a bargain can you get in a shirt? Really?
Well, shirts aren't sales tax, by the way, Marjorie. Clothes up to 100 and some.
My point is you get a discount on the shirt, and you're thrilled with the discount on the shirt, even if it's like $5, Jim.
Would you buy – forget the sales tax holiday for a second. Would you buy something you wouldn't ordinarily buy because someone said, I've got great news for you, Marjorie, it's 6% off?
Well, I'll tell you what. It's June, 24th today, I guess?
Something like that.
June 24th. If I needed a new washer dryer, which I might, and I might say, hey, no, I just wait till –
That's
August
my point. How does that help the economy? You're going to buy the thing anyway.
Wait, I'm not saying it helps the economy. I'm saying it's fun.
Oh,
it's
fun. I'm for the fun part.
It's a fun thing
Fine.
At the end of this year. You know, September's coming. I mean, kids will be back in school. That'll be great. But most people are depressed when the summer's over. They have to go back to, you know, school, and it's fall, and the winter's coming, all
the
kind of
stuff. I think
they're
going to be excited about going back to school, actually, this year.
Well,
but I hear your point.
They probably will. I'm always upset when the summer's over. So you have a little treat in September.
I agree. That's why I am trying to be a compromiser here. By the way, we should make clear, while the governor announced his proposal yesterday, the legislature's got to approve it, so it's not yet a done deal. When he joins us in about a half hour, he'll tell us I hope he'll tell us about whether or not he's getting any feedback from legislative leaders as to whether or not this will become a reality or not. 877-301-8970, either to comment on the sales tax holiday, 2 months long, being proposed, or to compliment me for not being the most rigid person on the planet, which I ordinarily am. I never change a position on anything, Marjorie would say. And by the way, one other thing, I have never driven anything across the damn New Hampshire line to save the sales tax. Not even a bottle of liquor, by the way. I've never done that. So,
well, I used to say we used to have the Volvo with the Save the Whales
thing
on the back.
Oh, my God.
Now you got a snappy car, Jim.
I do have a first snappy car in my whole life.
Snappy car.
I do have a snappy car. Thank you. You know where I bought that in New Hampshire? It's not true. It is not true. Doug in a car, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Hi there, Doug. Welcome.
Hi. Big fan.
Thanks.
I guess one of the questions that I have is I thought that the federal stimulus money could not be used to finance tax cuts, so I'm just kind of wondering if you know the answer to that, or maybe you could ask the governor when he comes on.
Wait, give us that one more time, Doug. Ask it one more time, please.
So I had thought that there was a stipulation that any of the federal stimulus money could not be used to finance tax cuts. So since the stimulus is what's creating part of this surplus, I'm just wondering how that works. Maybe it's a misunderstanding that I have, or there's some type of a loophole that...
Well, by the way, we'll do two things. Not only will we ask the governor, one of our colleagues in the control room will check to confirm that you're right. And frankly, I had forgot. I think you may be right that it can't be used. Of course, the governor might say it's other money that's going to that purpose. But let's find out if your underlying assertion is true. And I promise you, if it is, we will ask the question. Doug, thank you much. Yeah. For your call. 877
you can answer that one. You're the tax man.
301-897. Well, you understand what Doug's question is, assuming that he's factually right, that part of the legislative language with the stimulus payments, he can't use it to cut people's taxes.
Right.
I'm not sure if that's true or not. And I guess Doug would argue that at least part of this sales tax holiday, which is a tax cut, is being funded by federal funds. But our colleagues will check it out, and then we will ask. Michael and Waylon, where are you on this proposed two-month sales tax-free holiday?
Hi, guys. Long-time listener.
Thanks.
So I think we'll probably negotiate it down to a week or 2 weeks, and that would honestly be great. 2 months seems kind of crazy thing to blow all that on money on. I also just want to make a shout out reminder that Massachusetts funding its government with a sales tax is extremely regressive. And if we could push towards property taxes or something else, that would be a better model.
Well, actually, you were doing great for halfway. Property taxes are about as regressive as they get, Michael. Actually, a graduated income tax, which is essentially what the millionaire's tax is that's going to be on the ballot next November, that is, if equity is your concern, is the fairest way to go. But continue, Michael. I'm sorry.
That's a short way of saying it. Obviously, a flat property tax, not the best way to go, obviously, for smallholders and elderly homeowners. But, the millionaire's tax. If you could poke the governor on that one, that would be awesome.
Let's be clear here. Where are you on the sales tax holiday thing?
I think it's long. I think a week would be good, or 2 weeks.
Yep.
Blow it all on the 2 months seems excessive. And I think probably because this is going to be popular regardless, I suspect that the House might end up negotiating it down.
Well, that's a good point. My guess is they may split it in half, too. And I'm sort of where you are, is extend it. I never supported it even for 2 days. But this year I'm with Marjorie. It's a special time. Give people a little bit of a break and expand it to maybe a week or two and invest the rest of the money. Michael, thank you very much for your call. 877-301-8970 is our phone number.
Pam says a cynic in her. Says this has a lot to do with Baker's unannounced run for a third term.
Well, I mean, in all fairness to Governor Baker, and it may be part or all politically motivated, the guy's at like 70% approval. I don't think he needs a tax-free month or two to add to those numbers. But of course, it's these kinds of things are generally popular with voters. I'm not sure how popular, but they are popular. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to, is it Michael in Virginia? Hi, Michael.
It is. Hey, Michael.
Hello again.
Hello again.
I know. I'm your worst nightmare. But
no, you're not. What are you talking about?
No, we have a couple of worst nightmares, Michael. I'm not sure how many, but we have a few. Go ahead.
Okay. So I talked to you. You know what?
We'll put you on hold for a second, Michael, and we'll get back to you. You got to resolve. You got to turn the radio off, by the way, in the background. It's creating a bit of a problem. We'll put you on hold. We'll put you on hold for a second. Thank you for the call. Can we put Michael on hold, if we would, please? Thank you. 877-301-8970 is the phone number.
Denise from Fall River. Hi, Denise.
Hey, Denise.
Hey, how are you guys?
Great.
Lovely day.
Yep.
I was thinking about this as I am waiting, formerly patiently, now a little bit impatiently, for an electric bike.
Yeah.
I'm getting a little older and haven't gotten my new knee during the pandemic.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a costly item, and it's going to involve also getting a hitch for my car and a rack to carry the two e-bikes, because a friend of mine and I, you know, bike together.
Great.
But here's the thing. Goods are so back ordered that even if you have a 2 month period of time, you don't get taxed on it until it ships. If you're buying it, or you're walking into a store, and in this case, a local bike shop, but he's been waiting and it's been delayed and delayed and delayed. My hitch was supposed to come in this week. It was delayed until next month. Now they're saying I'm going to get it a week before Labor Day. So, you know, people who would say, hey, yeah, this is great, and go out and, you know, try to purchase something and then find out it's backloaded for 2 months, they're really going to get taxed when it comes in.
Yeah, but Denise, I would argue that particularly if you're doing a brick-and-mortar store, which I hope most people would do with this savings should it become law, work it out with your local retailer. Just say, I want to pay you today. So, which is, I'm assuming, he or she would be happy to take. And if you trust them enough, then you do get it. And you don't have to do what would be the normal situation, pay when it comes in. So try that and let us know. Denise, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah, a lot of people. Robin just emailed about the same thing, saying it's really hard to get major appliances. Because of manufacturing shutdowns, during COVID, that they're very hard to get. There's a lot of wait for getting some of these things. A lot of people are worried about that. You know, only high rollers going to take advantage of this. We should point out that it's not going to cover cars. Gail was worried about
$2,500 cap, as you said.
Mercedes Benz or something like that. It's not going to pay for a Mercedes Benz. It's not going to pay for boats. And as you just said, not above $25,000.
Well, you know what you can do, by the way,
$2,500.
I've thought of doing. Is I was interested in buying a Mercedes-Benz during the last sales tax thing. So I was thinking of buying the wheels. That was under $2,500.
Hey.
Buying the carcass of the car, whatever it's called.
You know,
then a door or two. And then putting it all together in my home.
What? Tires. You can get new tires at less than $2,500.
There is nothing like a couple of new tires. By the way, that's a good example of some. It's not, tires are not cheap. And you get four tires, it's at least $1,000 these days, right? You save 60. Again, it's not huge. It's 6%.
Well, you know,
it's a nice save.
It's like your late friend, the great Barbara Anderson, would say.
Yeah.
It's five pizzas or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like take
the pizzas. My traditional position is you can keep the pizzas and invest in things that matter to people. This year, as I say, I'm willing to make an exception because I am pro fun. And shopping for a lot of people, me, myself included, is fun. I'd prefer a 60% discount rather than a 6% discount. But if it makes people happy, as long as you don't spend the whole $900 million on it, it's okay.
Well, our frugal listener, Paul,
what do you say?
Points out that if we have enough extra money to have a tax-free 2 months, how about using it to fix infrastructure and other stuff that desperately needs it? As a big proponent of budgeting, this is like blowing your COVID stimulus money on crack cocaine.
Well, I mean, I guess that was my old position, but I'm modifying it a bit. Liz in a car, thank you very much for your call. Hi.
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 Can you hear me?
I can. We can. Yeah, sure.
Right. Okay. First time caller. I was so incensed that I had to pull over and call in.
Okay.
I think this is about the stupidest thing I've ever heard. If we have this kind of largesse available to us, now is the time to take on big projects. Let's put a high-speed train down the middle of the Mass Pike. Let's fix public higher education that's become unaffordable for most students in the Commonwealth and students who've really taken a hit during the pandemic with the cost of staying in education and trying to continue to manage loans while they're trying to juggle stuff at home. there are so many that let's bail out the tea so that we're not in the crisis with the tea every year. It's just so mind-boggling to me that we would piddle away this money giving people 6% breaks on things that they would buy anyway, when we can use this opportunity to make a huge impact on the quality of life for everyone in the Commonwealth.
Powerful first call, Liz. Thank you for the call.
There's a lot of people that agree with you. There's a quote from Senator Eric Lesser. He's a Democrat from Long Meadow. He says, sort of what you say, we could fix the T, repair our crumbling bridges, reduce class size, pay down our debt. Yeah, so I mean, I think Liz is representing a substantial number of people who think this is a terrible idea. I still
want my 6%. Of course you do, Marjorie. 877-301-8970. And again, if you're just tuning in, let me be clear. The fact the governor announced it doesn't mean it happens. Historically, I think pretty much. And by the way, there's a two-day holiday that would happen even if the legislature totally rejected this, because I think they voted a couple of years ago that every August something or other, there would be a two-day sales tax holiday. So even if they rejected in toto the governor's proposal, there'll be something. I think it's more likely, as a caller said, that the legislature will split it in half or do some such thing. And I'm more, I guess, willing to do a piece of it than I used to be.
And by the way, we also have this money from the American Rescue Plan, which Baker wants to spend on a lot of things like investments, roads, buildings, training, housing, and all that kind of stuff. We are, at the moment, rather flush with cash, which is a nice thing.
So, yeah, but I guess my response to that would be, if I was one of these callers, that's great. It's $5 billion. Well, this is another billion that we could add to that. You know, it's $900 million. That's what a lot of the callers seem to be saying. Let's go to Rhode Island, where Jake is on the phone. Hi, Jake. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jake.
Good.
Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
So I used to work at a furniture store in Massachusetts, and tax-free weekend was a zoo. Everybody comes in to get that 6% off. And especially last year during COVID, it was terrible. It was one of the reasons I left. It was super overwhelming.
Oh, no.
So I think extending it to, I think a month is excessive. I think 1 or 2 weeks would be good, maybe for retail stores, because we used to have to work 10, 11 hours. They wanted us to stay in the building for lunch. They would provide us lunch, but, you know, we didn't really get a break. So the tax-free weekend, I don't know about for other sectors of the economy, but as far as the large furniture stores go, it's always terrible. All hands on deck.
Hold on for a second, Jake. Okay, so it's terrible for you, but how excited were these people coming in to buy their couch or their bed or whatever they were buying? I mean, they were pretty excited, weren't they?
They were excited, but also I'm going to say I made a grown man cry last year.
Oh, no.
Because he felt that I was not paying him enough attention on the sales floor because it was so busy, and he very much wanted to make a purchase so he could get the discount. So he became so angry that he was swearing at me on the sales floor. So I think maybe that was a little bit of COVID, you know, the people were very tense last year. But I think extending it would be helpful to retail employees, and I think it would be good overall.
You know, Jake, thanks for the call. I didn't even remember that we did this. We didn't take a break in this during the pandemic. People were rushing out to stores last August to save 6 cents on a dollar in the middle of a damn pandemic.
I don't recall, but that's what the gentleman just said. He was in the store. That's why he had to leave the store, because he was traumatized by the frenzy. It was kind of like a Black Friday sort of thing, you know, it's dog eat dog, people shoving each other out of the way, trampling the security guards. Remember those awful stories about
people
Black Friday?
Died.
People run
people
you right over, and shove the door in, get in there and get their 1995 DVR player, whatever people used to buy years ago.
Well, I mean, before we take a break, Marjorie, the only reason she's doing this is because she wants to tell the story of one of our favorite stories, is we did this sad segment many years ago about a woman in Florida who was trampled. When she was trying to get a 1995 DVD, and we showed great sympathy. You know, we talked, I don't know if it was a GoFundMe page, but if there was,
she
we probably
Walmart.
Urged people to. And it turns out, we found out from Walmart the next day, 24 hours later, that she's been trampled many times, practically every single Black Friday, and then she sues.
That's right.
So the trampling was probably not totally legit.
But before that, they did the interview with her sister, who said,
"Oh, that's right,
like a herd of elephants. They left their footprints on her back. She was down on the ground with the DVD under, or the DVR, whatever the heck it was.
Oh, right, under her belly. That's
under
right.
Under her belly,
that's
and they just ran over like a herd. And then it turns out
same elephants every year. Got to take a break, Marjorie.
Okay. We're talking about turning a two-day state tax-free holiday into a two-month shopping spree. Keep you down 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about Governor Baker's move to make the state's two-day traditionally sales tax-free holiday into a two-month spending spree. We're asking you, is this the kind of break consumers need? Will it help you small business owners? Or, as some callers are suggesting, would the state be better off if tax dollars went into education, infrastructure, that sort of thing? And again, the governor will join us in about 20 minutes. And we'll hear his thoughts on this and some other things as well. 877-301-8970.
Okay, Tom just emailed and said, the pot shops will be tax-free. I'll cross the border and stock up. He's from New Hampshire. Alas, Tom, the pot shops are exempt from this. You're going to be paying full taxes
no
there.
No deal.
And at the liquor store. James says that Charlie Baker is being the estranged dad, trying to be the fun parent by buying the kids cake for lunch. 2 months of sales tax breaks are ridiculous.
Didn't the guy who also we put on hold, did he not email and apologize
for
the
Michael.
Screw up? I feel
bad.
Yeah,
Michael. Yeah, I feel bad because we couldn't hear him. It was a bad connection. He said he's really sorry. His dog was barking.
Oh, we'll have the dog call back then. And we'll... Rachel in New Hampshire, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Rachel. Hi. Hi, Rachel. Maybe you heard dogs barking too. Rachel, we'll put you on hold. We'll try to get back to you in a minute as well. 877-301-8970.
Emily in the car. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Emily. Welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
Excellent. Thanks for calling.
So the thing that scares me the most about this is how much I agree with Governor Baker. So I work in retail distribution, and our retailers need us more now than they ever have. I think there's been a lot of focus on, our economy reopening and giving a lot of support to restaurants and whatnot. I listen to NPR all day. I'm in the car. I'm a salesperson. I listen to Marketplace at the end of the night and hear, where Americans are spending their money. And they're overwhelmingly spending on services right now. My retailers are suffering. I walk into, my partners weekly and they ask me, is everyone else this slow? Is everyone else having such a hard time? And it's true. Our retailers are, they're hurting. And I forget the name of the caller who worked in the furniture store.
Yeah.
But I think he had a great point. Extend this for 2 months. Allow the residents of the Commonwealth to get out there and spend their money with confidence. Spend it on items that maybe they wouldn't have purchased. I need a new king-size mattress. I would love to go and buy this summer.
Yeah, you could get this. Emily, are you talking about clothing stores or what kind of retailers?
I work in liquor distribution. So my product is taxed well before you make it to the register.
Right.
So I think you just said you had an email about that.
Yeah, you're not going to get a deal. Marijuana and alcohol are not included in this.
Not in a liquor store. But, I have liquor stores who are... right next to clothing stores. And, what are the chances you go out for a day of shopping? Marjorie, I'm sure you can relate.
Because
have a wine shop next door? Why the heck not? I'll get a bottle of whatever. When people are out spending money, it encourages them, it empowers them.
Yeah.
And I think that there's nothing better that we could do. And I do agree that, education and I feel lucky I don't have to use the MBTA, but... a lot of things in the Commonwealth need a lot of work and a lot of attention. Rome wasn't built in a day, right?
Well, what's so weird about clothing stores, I'm sure it's changed now because we've lifted the restrictions, but I don't know, Emily, if you went in to buy something. I mean, I went to, in anthropology, I went to a Target, and you couldn't go into the dressing rooms. So or if you were going to go into the dressing rooms, you had to wait in a long line to get into the dressing rooms. That's different now, but talk about something that's a discouragement. I mean, you're going to buy a dress without trying it on. Well, people do that online, I guess. But you know what I mean, Emily? That was a real, and they were always, you're right, they were always kind of half empty and it was eerie.
Yeah.
What?
I mean, I agree with a lot of the positions of a lot of the callers, but I really think that, inserting money into the economy now It's especially in the summertime when historically retail sales are always lower than they would be in the, you know, colder months. So I think it's a great move.
Thank you very much for the call.
Good advocacy call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. By the way, an interesting an aside, The Hill is just reporting that the state Supreme Court in New York State has suspended Rudy Giuliani's law license over his election lies, I guess you would put it. 877-301-8970.
Delonte, I think Delonte. I pronounced
Delonte.
Delonte, I'm sorry.
Hey, Delonte.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Hey.
Hey.
Thanks for taking my call. How are you doing?
Excellent.
I wanted to say this, that I believe in compromise. So my compromise is this, is, okay, we do the extension. You want it for 2 months? I'll give you 2 months. But because we know our tax dollars have already gone to bail out these big box stores, these big corporations who got giant loans from us to get them through the hard times, to keep people employed, we know that majority of the small businesses weren't able to tap into those funds, and a lot of places closed. So, yeah, you want tax-free, then it only goes to companies that have less than 30 employees.
You're a genius. You are a total genius. That is brilliant.
And the reason why I say this is I work in mental health. I've talked to you guys before.
Yeah, we know.
I work in mental health. I work in adolescent mental health. The pandemic has exposed in this state, in this country, how much we are in need of inpatient, outpatient, community-based treatment for mental health and substance abuse disorders. I have teenagers who during this pandemic, and children and adults who needed inpatient treatment, who were deemed a danger to themselves or others by licensed medical professionals, sat in emergency rooms for 30, 40, 50 days waiting for inpatient treatment.
Oh, gosh.
We have seen an increase in juvenile drug abuse, and we have seen an increase in adolescent suicide attempts and suicides because we don't have the resources and because the schools were shut down. I talked to you guys about this before. How did the patients end up in my emergency room or on units? It's because mandated reporters throughout the school see the abuse that their patients are dealing with, their kids are dealing with, or see the depression or see the mental health, and they are sent to us because by law they have to. There's been none of that. There have not been any mandated reporters. So the level of drug abuse and mental health issues that's going on and our inability to meet that demand is scary, and it's not a lot being talked about it.
Delonte, that was an excellent, thoughtful call.
Thank you very much. And sorry for botching your name, Delonte, when you first called. Great points.
By the way, that small business thing, unless there's some statutory problem where you can't target it to certain – well, actually, but how can there be? Car dealers can't benefit, so you're targeting to non-car dealers, non-boat sellers, non-that sort of – why can't you target it to – businesses, as Delonte said, we'll ask. I mean, that's another great question. Rachel in New Hampshire, we'll try you again. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello. Good morning.
Hi.
I live in southern New Hampshire, and we get a lot of people from Massachusetts. So I think, and we love them all. But I think that doing the tax-free is actually an incentive for small businesses and box stores. For one thing, it keeps people in state. They get around. They can see other retailers. It can kind of help stimulate small business economy, perhaps, because people are staying there in their neighborhoods, and they say, oh, wait, that store's there. I'm going to try that.
I would guess that's part of the governor's motivation is that it will inspire people to shop locally and spend money places or at a time they may not otherwise. Interestingly, so you're basically telling us not to drive to New Hampshire and, as Marjorie said, shove the refrigerator in our trunk and violate the law, right?
No. fine. It's fine. The Costco on the border is like 99% mass people. But to your last callers.
I know.
Rachel.
It is pretty funny.
We're glad we got to you. Thank you so much. Thank you for the call.
But, you know, it's almost hard to resist going to liquor stores in Massachusetts if you're coming down the highway.
New Hampshire.
Yes, because they have those big, huge state liquor stores right by the, you know, simple on and off on the highway.
And so when you file your what you're supposed to do when you get something tax-free in New Hampshire and you're in that same product would be taxed in Massachusetts on your income tax return, I think your state income tax return, I think you're supposed to pay whatever you would have. You've done that every year.
I get those three bottles of wine right in there, Jim.
By the way, you accused me of doing the refrigerator and the trunk thing. Raise your right hand and tell me you have not bought something in New Hampshire that without a sales tax that would have had a sales tax in Massachusetts until you're not making eye. Whenever Marjorie, you're not here. Marjorie does not make eye contact, that means she's about to do something she almost never. What'd you do?
In New Hampshire, High Capacity Magazine. Don't you remember that?
Well, you did, but you didn't bring it home. That was one of your best stories. But she did go to a gun show and they said, and didn't you tell the gun seller that it violates Massachusetts law?
I said, you know, I'm from Massachusetts. I don't think I can do this. He said, hey, just don't let the state troopers stop you on your way home. And you give them cash and you can buy whatever you want.
And what was the High Capacity Magazine?
Capacity Magazine.
By the way, the one other story you did, not only was that a great story, we knew the Herald, you did a thing at a shooting range. And I'll never forget this. The headline in the Herald in the good old days was, Gun Packing Mama was a picture of Marjorie with the goggles holding whatever. What weapon were you shooting?
Torture. Let me tell you, Jim, I felt really powerful.
Did you really?
Very powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it to a certain degree. You know what I mean?
You do.
Yes.
In any case, so we are. We don't have more time to take your calls, but the governor's coming in a couple of minutes, and we can ask him about some of these sales tax issues that you have broached in the last few minutes.
Yeah, as Jim just said, up next, right after the news, that is, we're going to talk to Governor Charlie Baker, ask him how Massachusetts became Vaxachusetts, and a lot of other stuff about COVID and a lot of other stuff about the sales tax holiday. Governor Charlie Baker is next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Governor Baker will join us in just a minute. Then it's on to the GOP's latest fixation, the 40-year-old educational concept known as critical race theory that upholds the existence of systemic racism. But just in the past few months, bills have cropped up in state legislatures across the country trying to ban its teaching in schools. Former Education Secretary Paul Revel will join us to discuss this, and he'll weigh in on the debate on summer school versus fun.
The world of craft beer has long been a made-for-men, by-men energy to it. But now the women who do the work in the industry, and there are plenty of them, are speaking up about rampant workplace harassment, prompting a number of male brewery owners to step back from their roles. Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung will join us to talk Me Too and craft brew. That and more ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Friday, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. And for the first time, I guess, in 14 or 15 months, the governor is here for his monthly visit in studio. Governor Baker, it's good to see you. You look pretty much the same.
Good to see you guys, too. And you absolutely look very much the same.
Oh,
congratulations.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you.
It's harder and harder every day,
although,
let me tell you.
The older I get, the less I remember. So.
Let's not get into
glad
that.
Glad to hear that. Very glad to hear that, Governor. So it's not just me. So we were just talking. We got this sales tax holiday proposed for all of August and September.
Yeah.
And we were getting calls about it. And a couple of quick things. One of our callers just said that he was concerned about big businesses getting a break, you know, for their customers. He wanted this to be confined to smaller businesses. He said like 30 people and fewer
than
that.
Well, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Perfectly happy to talk to the legislature about that. I mean, part of the point here was to do two things. Number one, remember, you know, I signed a budget, the legislature voted on it, and that budget has had a surplus. That is what we're talking about here. Tax revenue came in way over where we thought it would. Now, there are some things that happen automatically when you have a surplus, especially with respect to capital gains tax revenue, which also came in high. That went directly to the stabilization fund, and we now have a $4.4 billion stabilization fund. It's the biggest stabilization fund in state history, and it will be very important at some point when we have, you know, a rainy day economically. But we have an overage. The people in Massachusetts, despite the pandemic and everything else, managed to generate a lot more tax revenue than we thought they would generate. And I think, you know, I think a deal's a deal. We should give that back to them. And by putting it through a sales tax holiday that lasts 2 months, especially if we can figure out how to do it specifically with respect to small businesses, I just have to figure out how complicated that would be. You're basically giving people a 6% cut on what they would normally pay for a whole bunch of items that are important to them. It goes right back into the economy in terms of helping benefit both the purchaser and the small business and the Main Street operator who's supplying it. And I think we owe some of this to the people in Massachusetts and to the small businesses. They've had a terrible year. And they performed at a rate that was above what we would have expected. We collected more money than we thought we were going to collect, and I think we should give some of it back.
By the way, we should give credit to Delonte, whose idea that was, and assuming you cut that deal with the legislature. One last sales tax thing I'm embarrassed to say I didn't think about. Another caller, whose name I forget, said, and we confirm it's true, and I'm sure you know it, the American Rescue Plan says that stimulus money can't be used for tax cuts.
Correct.
This is if you get your way, a $900 million tax cut. How are you not violating the provisions of the $1.9 trillion rescue plan?
Because this has to do with state tax revenue. It's just a function of where state tax revenue came in relative to budget. We're not proposing to spend any of the ARPA money, the so-called American Rescue Plan money on this. We made a series of separate proposals with regard to that, which was about the Commonwealth has received $5.3 billion in federal funding through the ARPA plan. Cities and towns have received about $3.5 billion, and school districts have received about $1.8 billion. It's literally like $10 billion to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, one way or the other. And we proposed spending about $2.8 billion of it on the state side on a variety of items, including about $1 billion on housing supports in a lot of the communities that were hit hardest by the pandemic, workforce training and credentialing programming for a lot of the folks who are out of work, money for our tourism and cultural communities, which have obviously had a really rough go over the course of the past year, try and jumpstart them a little bit. And then a big chunk of money on behavioral health and addiction services, which have been, you know, sort of blown up to some extent by all the issues around the pandemic.
You know, on that note, by the way, we've read that the legislature is fighting back a little bit, saying that the spending of this $5 billion should be collaborative, any part of it unilaterally by you. Your concern, at least as I read it, Governor, was we got to move with some urgency here. Why not give them a deadline? I mean, we've criticized the legislature pretty regularly for moving like snails. Why not say we'll do it collaboratively if you put something on my desk by pick a date, August 31st or whatever date you want, unless they're out buying things at a 6% discount. And after that date, I want to be able to spend it unilaterally because the people in Massachusetts can't wait. Isn't that a fair compromise?
That's an interesting idea, too. I think the you know, part of why we did it the way we did it, which was to take a piece of it and appropriate it. We did appropriate it. I mean, we didn't say we would spend it without appropriation. Mm-hmm. They need to approve it. But, you know, if you want to put money into tourism in Massachusetts, You probably ought to be putting it into Massachusetts tourism now, not in, I mean, you could do it in October or November, but to some extent you've missed a big piece of the tourism season. I would say the same about the cultural stuff too. And the job training piece, remember, you know, there's a lot of people, hundreds of thousands, whose unemployment benefits go away in September. And what we wanted to do was to put this money to work on skill building, credentialing programs, and sort of rapid reemployment programs, apprenticeships now, because those folks are going to be in a really difficult spot in September. So one of the reasons we didn't come up with proposals for all of it was our idea here was let's take some of the stuff we think we should do now. Now, your point is pick a date. If I were to pick a date, the date I would probably pick would be like – would be too soon for any plan that they would pursue. It would be like, you know, July 15th or something like that. The addiction and behavioral health stuff is real, and it's now.
But can you, the argument you're making, and I heard your argument for the spending that's $2.8 billion on affordable housing and related needs, can you make the same exact argument for the $900 million on the sales tax thing and saying, as much as I'd like to give a break to people, 6% off, and they deserve a break, they also deserve another $1 billion spent on all the things that I, Governor Baker, think are urgent. So instead of $2.8 billion, here's $3.8 billion, which will be better for everybody.
Unless you're one of those people who could really use the benefit of either operating a Main Street business that's trying to find a way back, or you're one of the people that benefits from the tax cut. But the other point I would make is, remember here, we're talking about the FY21 budget, which ends in, you know,
June 30th.
6 days, okay? We signed it. They voted on it, the legislature. We all agreed that this was the budget that was going to adequately fund us through this time. The people of Massachusetts and the businesses in Massachusetts created far more revenue than anybody thought we were going to create. That, I think, we should give back a piece of that to them, particularly after we make a very significant deposit to our stabilization fund, which will now be the largest it's ever been and one of the largest on a percent of budget basis in the country. So I just – look – we have a problem we almost never have. I never come in here and talk to you guys and say – the Commonwealth of Mass has $10 billion between the state and the cities and towns that it needs to figure out what to do with. And some of this stuff, I think, you know, we made a pitch. And I think the pitch we made, especially around the stuff we think there's urgency about, deserves consideration. And that's why we filed it as an appropriated bill to the legislature. But I think on this other part, I really think the people in Massachusetts overperformed. And because they overperformed, they should get it back.
We're talking to Governor Charlie Baker. We get a bunch of questions about COVID. Congratulations, we're in order. We're now one of the top states in terms of vaccination. You and all the people that did all this work to get these vaccinations out there.
Well, the real people who did the work were the people who got vaccinated. I mean, I talk to governors all the time who are incredibly frustrated about their inability to get their people to get vaccinated. I mean, we did not have that problem here. And we built a really terrific sort of mixed model approach to vaccinating people. And the folks who did this did amazing work. But if you build it and they don't come.
Well, that's one of the things I want to ask you about is the people that aren't coming. We have a lot of numbers of police officers, prison guards, and particularly scary to me are health care people that might be working in nursing homes or assisted living or with vulnerable people. I don't know how they can – you don't want a mandate. At the same time, these people, particularly the frail, are put at great risk by being – and they're – especially if you're assisted living or a nursing home, you're stuck. You're someone right next to you, very close up to you, that may not be vaccinated. So how –
Well, keep in mind that the over 75 population of Massachusetts at this point, more than 90% of them are vaccinated. And for the over 65 population, we're north of 80%. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the most recent numbers around long-term care, but they were somewhere in the 90%. They were more than 90% on the resident side, and they were north of 75%. I think they were around 80% on the staff side, too. And we continue to test, okay, regularly inside long-term care facilities to find out if there's anybody there who has COVID. And we're going to continue to do that surveillance testing as far into the future as we have to. But we haven't had – there are almost no cases in long-term care anymore.
But I guess it's a peace of mind thing. Yeah. At some point, you have to say, no shot, no job. You gotta wait until you get your shot. And I guess, why is the benefit to go to the person who's not going to get vaccinated as opposed to the person who's worried about someone being close to them?
Well, so far what we've done has worked exceedingly well in long-term care, and we pay a tremendous amount of attention to it for all the reasons you would expect. I mean, the data is very good at this point. I think the thing that might move the needle on this to some extent would be if I know that Pfizer and I believe Moderna have both now filed to get sort of what I would describe as permanent FDA approval.
Yes.
I mean, I can't tell you how many people have said to me, I'm not going to do this until this is something other than an emergency use authorization. I want to see the federal government say that this is, permanent in place. It's jumped through all the
hoops. So are you saying you consider some mandates once there's full licensure as compared to emergency use authorization?
I would rather talk about it at that point. I think it's a hard sell. I really do believe it's a hard sell. And I've done the face-to-face conversations with a lot of the people who are hesitant to get vaccinated. And the biggest issue I hear more often than not is it happened too fast. I don't really understand what the long-term impacts are going to be. And by the way, it's still operating under an emergency use authorization, which is a pretty good question.
We're talking to Governor Charlie Baker. Governor, speaking of nursing homes, you were last time you were here, well, you weren't here for more than a year. Last time we spoke to you was a day or two before the Globe put out their spotlight series on the horrible situation at Holyoke where 76 people died. We talked a lot about that. And we have a couple of questions about that Globe report.
Well, one of the things I want to ask you, Governor, Bennett Walsh, the man who ran the soldiers' home, he's gone. He's facing criminal neglect charges. There's a second guy that was also forced out, Francisco Urani, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Iraq Marine combat veteran, got shrapnel in his face, won a Purple Heart. After reading this Globe Spotlight team report, it seems to me pretty clear he's the fall guy here. He's the sacrificial lamb for this terrible tragedy. So what is it that Urani did wrong?
Well, I think first of all, there have been several reports written at this point. One was by the folks at the legislature who had hearings and testimony from literally hundreds of people. There's the Perlstein report, which is the one we commissioned after the incident and the tragedy that took place there. And the attorney general's issued a similar kind of document. They all basically say the same thing, which is there was nowhere near enough supervision of Bennett Walsh. They also say that the organizational structure that this thing operates under needs to change, and that the fact that the administration does not appoint the superintendent, the board appoints the superintendent, that the connectivity between the board, the superintendent, and the executive office of Veterans Services needs to be dealt with as well. And
don't you appoint the board members and
the head guy
isn't that your appointment on the board?
The four people, the board has seven members. At the time they appointed Bennett Walsh, four of them were appointed by the previous administration. The chair was appointed by the previous administration. And the guy who ran the search said publicly that no one reached out to him or contacted him or interfered in any way with their search and ultimate decision with respect to who they chose to run the place.
So you're saying that the fact that Bennett Walsh had no medical experience, this kind of thing, and was it very, as the Globe put it, wire political family, that seemed to be certainly what they were saying. This was unusual. And as you know, there was a lot of complaining about him from the very first day. And it seems as though Mary Lou Sutters knew a lot about this right from the beginning.
I would disagree with that. I think the story in which the Springfield Republican talked about the fact that no one interfered, no one called anybody associated with the decision they made to hire Bennett Walsh, that was a story that went where the headline was something like, from a great choice to something else. But his appointment was viewed at the time by folks in Western Mass as a win.
Just what did Urena do wrong, though? He was forced out.
He was the guy who oversaw those folks. And look, I said at the time that I think Secretary Urena was a spectacularly strong voice for veterans. I continue to believe that. And there's so many things about the Holyoke Soldiers Home that distress me and depress me. And I think about that issue practically every day. And after the Pearlstein report came out, I called 100 families that lost somebody, whether they lost somebody to COVID or not, in the months of March, April, and May, and June. And I probably talked to 80 of them. And some of those phone calls lasted 5 or 10 minutes. Some of them lasted over an hour. And I consider that whole thing to be just a staggering tragedy. And the work that was done by Val Liptak from Western Mass Hospital and the National Guard, who we brought in as soon as we realized how much trouble that place was in, was spectacular. But every report that's been done on this says the same thing, which is the chain of command here didn't work.
Well, since you brought up the Pearlstein report, the only other thing I want to bring up here is the Globe said he was guilty of errors and omissions, which, frankly, my reading of it is being kind. One reads the Globe report, which I'm sure you did. It seemed to me they exaggerated the oversight responsibilities of the Secretary of Veterans Affairs and downplayed the oversight responsibilities of Secretary Sutter's. Pearlstein goes on to say, in terms of the whole hiring process, including your role in it, it was beyond the scope of his responsibility, which I don't get at all. But the most egregious example of the whole thing Marjorie was talking about, Sutter's versus Urena here, is this thing in late March where Walsh finally did the right thing about something, asked for the National Guard because so many people aren't showing up. In the Pearlstein report, he says something like, Walsh sends an email asking for the National Guard to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, end of story. And he fails to mention, this is Pearlstein, fails to mention that 6 minutes later, Urena sent an email to two higher-ups who work for Sutter's asking for help. They apparently showed no sense of urgency, and then he compounds the problem as Pearlstein governor when he testifies in front of the legislature and said that Urena denied the request, which is totally untrue. And by the way, we tried getting Pearlstein, and his response to us was, we need Baker administration approval, and we didn't get it. My conclusion from this Globe thing, and obviously please tell me if you think this is unfair, that Pearlstein was more loyal to the governor's office, the administration, than he was to the taxpayers of Massachusetts. It was a thoroughly incomplete report. Is that unfair?
Yes.
Why?
First of all, he wasn't asked to do a study on everything associated with the Holyoke Soldiers Home dating back 3-4 years or whatever. He was asked to do one thing, what happened and when, and put together a TikTok associated with, you know, all the events between, call it March 10th and when people finally found out about this at our level, which was Alex Morse, the mayor of Holyoke, called us on a Sunday night. And his TikTok has been overwhelmingly adopted by basically everybody else. And it's consistent as well with what the legislature and their report called the TikTok, and it's consistent with what showed up in the AG's report.
How about this National Guard thing? That is, he's totally placing blame on Urena, which is not where the chain ended.
So I think, I can't remember if it was in the news reports or in one of the stories, but Mayor Morse, the main reason he reached out on Sunday night to the lieutenant governor was because he was not satisfied that his conversation with Secretary Urena demonstrated that people understood the urgency with which he believed we needed to act. And it was Morse's phone call on Sunday night that actually got Val Liptak and the National Guard on site on Monday morning. That's a fact.
Okay. We're talking to Governor Charlie Baker. I guess a COVID-related thing. We talked a lot about summer school here and became obsessed with the need for it. In fact, for a while, I thought it should be mandated. And then we read a Globe editorial the other day talking about how fun should be, sort of fun for shoppers with a tax break, fun for students during the summer. And this is a serious question. One, what are you doing on the summer school front? And two, what's your response to the notion these kids, at the same time that we don't want them to fall so far behind that they never catch up, we also, they need a break from from the pain and the stress and the depression of this nightmarish year?
Well, I guess I would argue that both points are legit. We've put about $70 million of our money into supporting summer programs, and we fully expect that a lot of cities and towns will use, I hope, a big piece of the federal money that they got to support summer programming as well. It's a perfect example of where you should be spending your money this summer. But there are two pieces associated with what happened to kids over the course of this year. The first piece is the learning loss, which summer school absolutely needs to be part of. But the second part was the isolation and the lack of sort of social skill development and gatherings. I mean, kids, for the most part, like to be with other kids, and it's a big part of how they learn how to play and share and relate to one another. And what people have said to me is that summer school needs to be some combination of an academic exercise for those who need it and an enrichment. And the word they use is enrichment programs. They don't necessarily use play. I think that's legit. I think the goal here ought to be to give kids a summer that provides them with, you know, support around learning loss, but also recognizes and understands that there needs to be a, for lack of a better word, an opportunity for them to do the kinds of things that kids would typically do at recess or on the weekends. I mean, we basically kept kids away from each other for the better part of a year.
So you're talking about in the fall, no masks for the kids and they go back to school, right? And what about the social distancing part?
I don't think we need that either.
So it just be as normal as it was, as normal as it can be, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind that at this point in time, there are no communities in Massachusetts that are yellow or red. They're all basically green and gray, and most of them are gray. And gray means you don't even have enough COVID to be green. And we're going to keep vaccinating people all the way through the summer and into the fall. And we are continuing to run our testing program for those school districts that want to do it. And the testing numbers at this point are as low as they've ever been. So I think at this point in time, our view is the fall should look a lot like it did in the fall of 19. Now, if something happens between now and then, obviously the rules could change. But I think our view is kids, for the most part, are, I think at this point, I'm going to say around 50% of the kids between the ages of 12 and 19 are vaccinated. A lot of the colleges are having mandatory vaccination requirements for kids coming back. I expect at some point the 2 to 11 clinical trials will get done. And when those are completed, I think there'll be an opportunity for people to actually start to get vaccinated. And we'll obviously do what we can to help encourage that. But at this point, all the adults have had opportunities to get vaccinated, and the vast majority of teachers and staff have. So I sort of think we should try and make this as normal as possible, given the fact that the data at this point, especially around kids and COVID, is actually not bad.
Yeah, we're talking to Governor Charlie Baker. Governor, I know one of the things you really like when you talk to us monthly is when we ask the exact same question we asked the prior month. That is one of your favorite things, is it not?
It, among others.
Among others, yeah. So I asked you last month why you're still
why
you're still a Republican.
Oh,
and
okay.
I'd like to re-ask the question with I mean this totally sincerely. Don't get aggravated. This is
You mean because I crossed my arms?
Since we saw you last, a significant chunk of your Republican Party in the state seems hell-bent on running someone against a governor who's got 70% approval rate. They have the leader of your – well, you're the leader, but the leader of the state party has refused to do whatever he can to get rid of a grotesquely homophobic member of the state committee. And in fairness to you, you've condemned her comments. On the federal level, your fellow Republicans in Congress vote against a January 6th commission, vote against even a debate on a voting rights bill. Forget the bill itself, on a bill. I mean this with total sincerity. I'm not suggesting you're Bernie Sanders-like, but if today you were deciding what party I want to sign up for to vote in a primary, why would you vote to be a Republican rather than a Democrat?
Because the part of the Republican Party that causes you so much heartburn in many cases causes me heartburn. And I do believe, and I've said this a million times, that I think it's better to have two parties than one. And I think that's really important for the Commonwealth. And I think it's important, frankly, for the country. And I've said many times that the complete and utter breakdown in collaborative behavior in Washington is hugely bad for the country. And I'm actually a little bit excited, is probably too strong a word. I'm a little bit positive about the fact that it does seem, at least on infrastructure, a bunch of Democrats and a bunch of Republicans in the Senate and the president may have reached an agreement on a cooperative bill on this. And I don't think the way to solve the problems that you point to in the Republican Party is to run away from it. I think the way to solve them is to stay and make the case and fight for what I believe, which is a very New England Republican. I completely agree. I plead guilty to that. But I would also argue that that practical and pragmatic approach and that appreciation for the fact that this is not a business in which you're supposed to get your way all the time is a good thing.
Were you okay with the 50 out of 50 Republican senators voting against even a debate on the voting rights
bill? No, of
course
not.
Okay.
So, Governor Baker, earlier today we spoke with a gentleman.
I was on your show.
Go ahead.
I'll go way back, okay? I remember being on your show when Merrick Garland was put up to be
President
Obama to be on the Supreme Court. And you said, and Mitch McConnell was saying at the time they weren't gonna give him a hearing. And I remember it happened to be at a particular time in Massachusetts, and I said, I heard something yesterday that I think is absolutely right on this, and it's called Do Your Job, which was hold the hearing, deliver the vote. I thought that was disgraceful. And so any situation or circumstance where people just flat out deny the right or the opportunity for people to engage on a discussion about an issue that's really important to the public, and certainly this one is, I don't support that kind of behavior at all.
Governor,
in fact, I'd love to see the legislature have a big debate on my $2.8 billion proposal for what we should do with our ARPA money.
So before you go, earlier today we talked to a gentleman who said he's gotten in touch with your office on many occasions.
I wouldn't start there. He said,
Hold on.
Tell the governor.
Can I get there myself? Thank you very much. He does this to me a lot, Governor Baker.
Sorry, I apologize.
I've noticed that.
Yeah, he does.
Thank you.
So he's tried to reach your office on many occasions, hoping to make you.
He does it to me a lot, too.
That makes me feel good because you're bigger
Marjorie,
than he is.
Okay, Marjorie, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Hoping to make you a national star. I'm sure he's not alone in doing that. And we spoke to him about how, you've rejected all his overtures. He relayed to us this morning that he does not bite.
Those were his words.
Yes. And want to guess who that might be?
He wanted us to convey to you that he does not bite.
Right.
You know who it is?
Do you know, I have how much interest I have in being a national star?
That's what Marjorie told him. Chuck Todd.
Chuck Todd
wants you to meet the press, and we said we'd convey the invitation.
The Sunday shows are after you, Chuck Todd's and the other ones, and you've turned them down repeatedly. That's why.
You know what I do with the media time that I have available?
No.
I try to talk to local TVs, local radios, and the people who actually cover the work and the stuff that we do here in Massachusetts. And I, the shiny ball of national star, I have zero interest in that. And we've talked about this before. People ask me when Senate seats have come up or something like that, any interest in running for federal office? No.
Any interest in running for state office?
Again?
My wife and I will make that decision in conjunction with the lieutenant governor.
How much, before you love, how much do you love being asked that question? You do love being asked the question incessantly. Do you not tell the truth? Look at the smile. The answer is yes.
No, the answer is...
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Love it as much as you love to ask
the
question.
Do you love being
time.
Asked the question? Tell
no,
the truth.
No, I don't like being... I fully expect to be asked the question, right? Because it's obviously something my wife and I think about, too. So I understand why it's on people's
when
minds.
When are you telling us, by the way?
When we make a decision.
Oh, that's a good
time. I promise
you'll be...
In
line.
In line, absolutely. Maybe I should call Chuck Todd and tell him first.
Well, he's,
Governor Baker, it's
he's
good to see you
call,
in person.
Governor
and by
Baker.
The way, he shakes hands. I'm really glad because there were all those articles, including from Fauci, who said handshaking was a thing of the past, and I don't want it to be. So,
the people in Massachusetts have done a spectacular job of getting vaccinated, and these vaccines work. and it makes it possible for us to do a lot of things that are fundamental to our ability to see each other as people. And I, you know, honestly, I know this sounds kind of corny, but the fact that I haven't actually seen Karen Spilka or Ron Mariano in person, except maybe at one event for a couple of minutes, and that we don't actually sit down and eat, you know, stale cookies and drink bad coffee once a week, I think it's a problem. I really do. I think the, you know, human beings see each other as people when they spend time with each other in person. And I really hope that one of the things that comes out of all that year of isolation and all the rest is not just a return to some degree of normalcy, but people actually starting to treat each other the way they normally treat each other, who they deal with on a regular face-to-face basis, which is as people. It's so easy for everybody to get nuts about somebody you never see, ever. And that's kind of where we've been for the last year, and I don't think it's a good thing.
We're with you, Governor. Thanks so much for your time. It's really okay.
good to see you.
Thank you very much. Governor Baker, thanks again for coming in. We appreciate it. Up next, we're going to be joined by journalist Bill McKibben, who joins us for that conversation about the Keystone Pipeline officially dead. Would Biden pass the next climate change challenge? All those questions. Keep your dial on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And after 10 years of controversy and protest, Keystone Pipeline is dead. Earlier this month, a developer announced it's pulling the plug after the Biden administration revoked its permit. I think that was in January. Now the Biden administration faces another climate change test, the Line 3 pipeline. It's a major construction project which would carry oil across sensitive waterways and tribal lands. As Bill McKibben characterized it, this is Keystone, the sequel. Bill McKibben joins us on the line to talk about, well, he joined us the other day, too, but only for about 2 minutes, and other environmental headlines. He's the founder of 350.org and the Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College. His latest book is Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? He also writes the brilliant, we love, The Climate Crisis, which is the New Yorker's newsletter on the environment. Bill, we're hoping you make it for a full 5 minutes today. Good to talk to you.
It is no thunderstorms. It is as beautiful and clear a day as northern New England knows. The Red Sox are marginally in first place. How could things be better? It does, though, let one feel with real emotion what people are going to be going through this week in the Pacific Northwest when they're going to see temperatures that they've never recorded there as that heat wave moves on shore, and it's really a reminder of how lucky we are sometimes.
Well, you know, before we get to the whole pipeline thing that you were at, a lot of times, from what I've read, Bill McKibben, that these torrential rains that we're seeing more and more of, these really violent thunderstorms, that's part of what's going on with climate disruption, too. I don't know if it was related to what happened in Vermont where we lost your connection last time we were talking to you, but this certainly seems to me just anecdotally happening more and more and more.
It's not anecdotally. The data is really clear. In the Northeast United States, we've seen an increase of something like 75% over the last half century in those storms that drop more than 2 inches of rain in a course of 24 hours, the real gully washers that do nobody any good. And really, Marjorie, if you want one fact to just store in your mind to understand the 21st century, you could do worse than warm air holds more water vapor than cold. That explains why we get these, you know, horrible droughts and with them horrible fires. And it explains why once that water's evaporated up into the atmosphere, it comes down in wet areas and it comes down like we've never seen it before. I mean, we've had in the last 3 years by far the two biggest rainstorms in American history, and more to come, I'm afraid.
Talking to Bill McKibben. So, Bill, I quoted you as saying line three was Keystone, the sequel. If you were to sit down with Joe Biden, anybody would sit and say, why a no to Keystone and why not a no, at least so far, to line three? What's the answer?
Yeah. Well, I have really no real idea why this isn't a no-brainer. It's a pipeline of exactly the same size carrying exactly the same stuff. So if in 2015 Keystone XL fails Obama's climate test, it's hard to imagine how it passes Biden's in 2021. The best guess I can come up with is they're worried about losing votes on their infrastructure bill, which is truly important, and they don't want to, rattle anyone's cage. But that's as good as I got, because there's no logical reason at all that we should be building a new tar sands pipeline designed to last for 50 years. Just as, remember, this is exactly the same company building it that built the infamous Weymouth compressor.
That's right. Of course, Enbridge, right.
And you remember that extraordinary piece in the Globe that detailed the really dirty backroom dealings that got that thing done. People are still doing all they can to stop it, and there's active fights that may bring it down, just as people are doing everything they can to stop Line 3. It's been remarkable to watch the indigenous community organize the heck out of it, and it was really beautiful to be out there in that Minnesota marshland a couple of weeks ago, at a place where you could literally hop across the Mississippi and just be, just be reminded of what a beautiful, beautiful world it is we still inhabit.
By the way, speaking of infrastructure, as you were speaking, Bill McKibben, a bipartisan group of Republican and Democratic senators are speaking to the press outside the White House saying that there is a deal. Biden has said we do have a deal on infrastructure, as we discussed with Chuck Todd earlier today. So we don't want to incur your wrath, Bill McKibben, but we read your piece in The New Yorker about advocating for slow travel, and you made the case against supersonic transport. We don't need Concorde, the sequel. However, there are no two bigger advocates for high-speed rail than Marjorie Egan and I. And we were talking this morning and saying, is Bill McKibben ever going to talk to us again? Do you want to disabuse us of our support, or is it okay?
Anything that travels on a rail is fine with me. You know, my town of Middlebury has just spent the last 3 years, we dug up the whole center of the town and in order to redo the rail line. And I'm very, very looking forward to the moment when I can get on the train and end up. I want to go see the one thing I want to see in New York City after the pandemic is the new train hall that they've inaugurated where Penn Station used to be. Because, part of it is when I was trying to get it at that piece is we have to just think about travel a little differently. Now that we all, are connected to each other all the time, it's not like we really have to be someplace overnight, One of the things we learned in the pandemic is as long as you've got an internet connection, you can do what work you need to do. And hence, it kind of opens up the prospect. I was writing in there about these people who are starting to figure out how to use blimps.
Yeah, blimps.
For passenger travel. And think what an elegant, imagine taking a trip out of Boston up over the New England mountains in the autumn on your way to Montreal, just drifting slowly up the spine of the Appalachians in a blimp. Think how beautiful that would be. And if you had to be working at the same time, you could. So I strain sometimes, maybe too hard, to find the things that are going to be delightful about the world we could be building in the place of the one we've got.
Well, but as you also point out, it's sort of a schizophrenia here, because the Boston Globe is reporting about how business travel people are reassessing, as you say, do they really need to go to California for a one-hour business thing when they've now learned that Zoom can be very effective. On the other hand, you point out that United Airlines wants to buy these supersonic jets we just talked about, so you can go to San Francisco to Tokyo and back in one day. That does seem. Yes. They obviously think there's money to be made here. They wouldn't be doing it. So,
Well, there may be money to be made, but you know, we really are reaching a point where someone's going to have to ask slightly deeper questions about new projects than that. I mean, supersonic jets use something like 5 times as much energy as conventional airplanes, which are already a huge problem. I find it hard to believe that it's worth allowing such a thing to happen.
Talking to Bill McKibben. So let's move from supersonic transport to cars. And, you know, I know you a little bit. I don't see you as a guy who is about to buy an F-150, but you never know. And you were talking in a piece you wrote. Is that a fair characterization of you, Bill McKibben, or no?
Fair enough. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I figured.
As long as I've got room to stick my skis in the car, I'm okay. Very happy.
So you were celebrating the fact, and we did too, even before we saw your New Yorker piece, about the fact that it's announced that the F-150 is about to go electric, and I'm saying to myself, this is going to sell about maybe two of them are going to sell, because this is not exactly the kind of person who's looking for an electric vehicle, the typical F-150 drive. They were gone in a nanosecond. So
they're going to sell. Within a few years, this will completely replace. And this probably more importantly than blimps, this is a good example of how some things are going to get much better as we take seriously the crisis we're in. So think about your electric Ford F-150. If you like to drive fast, it drives a lot faster than the old one. You can't believe the acceleration in these kind of vehicles, but that's not the point. You don't really need to drive a pickup truck fast. If you actually use a pickup truck on a job site or something like that, what you've now got is essentially a huge battery on wheels. So you can, you can run every tool you've got all day long. Without having to haul around the stinking noisy
point.
Generator that you use now. And it's not like most people who buy pickup trucks actually need them for anything, you know. Something like 95% of all the huge SUVs in America never get driven off a paved road. But all the sort of people and all the sort of suburbanites who buy these enormous things, take their cues from the carpenters and whoever who actually need them. And so I think it won't be long. I think one of the easiest parts of the energy revolution is going to be convincing people that they want electric vehicles because they're way better than what came before.
And the caveat, I mean, that people always say, I love this, but how am I going to drive from here to New York City or from here to New Jersey? I mean, how do you see this happening with these charging stations?
Well, let's find out what's in Joe Biden's infrastructure bill today. Hopefully, they kept in the part about the 500,000 EV chargers, because that's the answer to that question lies exactly there.
You know, you had a statistic that really surprised me in this piece you wrote about the electric Ford trucks. Public transit accounts for about 1% of passenger miles traveled. I was
Isn't that
stunned.
Depressing?
Yeah, and I was stunned. I guess that's because the East Coast, West Coast, not the West Coast even so much, have like MBTAs and MTAs.
And look, plenty of people ride it, but the great distances get traveled by people riding alone in cars.
Yeah.
That's the American, and we should work very hard to change that. And, you know, hopefully that'll be part of the infrastructure bill, too. But given the realities of things, we're also going to have electric vehicles if we're going to make a significant dent in emissions from transportation. But yeah, our I'm afraid, Marjorie, that at least in the very short run, the pandemic made that worse.
Yes.
I think that probably the subway, the T may be one of the last places to get back to full utilization.
You know, Bill McKibben, I want to stay on the electric vehicle thing just for a second. Let's assume that the 500,000 additional charging stations doesn't make it in. The argument for those opposing it in the Republican Party is if private industry is selling a lot of electric cars, then it's in their interest to start creating charging stations to serve those cars. One, will that happen? I know your preference is the Biden plan, but will it happen? And two, what's the two price differential questions? One, electric vehicle versus non-electric vehicle, and electric power versus gas power in a vehicle. What are the differentials there?
So to the first question, you know, if we weren't in a climate crisis, then it would make entirely good sense to just wait for the you know, automakers to slowly unroll the charging stations and whatever. But as you know, the world's climate scientists have told us that if we don't cut emissions in half by 2030 around the world, then the Paris climate targets we set with such fanfare 6 years ago are by the board. That's almost a literal deadline, Jim. And so it behooves us to now move fast, to do all we can to move heaven and earth, as it were. As to the differential, the price differential and things, you can buy a good EV for less than the price of the average new car in America. And once you've bought it, it's way cheaper to run. I think at this point, everybody agrees that the lifetime costs of owning an EV are much smaller, not just because you're not buying gas, but because they have so few moving parts and there's so little to fix in them. The problem is not, I mean, we're definitely going to be using electric cars 25, 30 years from now. That's all there'll be because they're better. But we have to do it now because otherwise we're going to be, you know, motoring our way around a world that's just broken.
We're talking to Bill McKibben, environmentalist extraordinaire. You know, this made me happy. I was kind of surprised by it, that Maine became the first state in the nation where the legislature, this isn't just, you know, like public pension system like in cities, where the legislature and the governor has agreed to sell fossil fuel assets. How big of a deal is this? Yeah, and why Maine?
It's a huge deal. It's a huge deal, and it happened in Maine because of great organizing, Maine Youth for Climate Justice, Maine 350, Sierra Club Maine. Lots and lots of people did a great job of forcing this issue, and it was actually an easy conversation to be had because you can't make money anymore in fossil fuels. They've been the worst performing part of the economy now for decades. So there's every reason to do it and no reason not to, and hopefully, I mean, one always remembers that Maine began life as part of Massachusetts. Hopefully,
God, that's right. That's right.
That spirit, that sentiment will translate back south to Beacon Hill, where there's a similar bill that could be approved at any time, divesting the Massachusetts pension funds. And I'll note that just this morning, since we're speaking about ancient history here, some lawmakers on Beacon Hill have filed a bill that would force Harvard to divest its fossil fuels. It turns out that there's some clause in the Massachusetts Constitution giving the legislature oversight powers over what was then the only university in the state, and they're hoping to use that to try and move, you know, the unmovable and arrogant Harvard to finally take climate change seriously.
Where Bill McKibben went to school. I should, well, you know that old line. I'm sure you've used it many a time, Bill McKibben. As goes Maine, so goes Harvard. You've heard that before,
absolutely.
Have you not? You know, Bill McKibben,
absolutely.
How are you feeling about Biden? I was about, 6 months in, whatever it is. You were pretty optimistic about him as an environmental president. How are you feeling halfway into the first year?
Well, look, the guy's got such a hard hand. He's president of the United States, but it's like Joe Manchin is prime minister of the United States, you know, and everything has to, you know, go through him, too. And so I have great sympathy for the predicament he finds himself in. But I think that there's no doubt but that his the patience is wearing a little thin. The story just out this morning saying that the Department of Justice was upholding the Trump arguments in this Line 3 debate before a federal judge. And that's not okay. I mean, it's upholding anything that the Trump – I mean, this was an administration that believed climate change was a hoax. So why we're forced to take as serious precedent anything they had to say about the environment or energy seems silly to me. So one looks at President Biden and just understands how much hope has to rest on him on so many things. He's got to somehow rescue our democracy and keep it from dissolving into the well, into the very near what we nearly, very nearly had on January 6th. And that's a hard, hard job. And he's got to, at the same time, tackle this climate crisis. And he can't put it off because physics won't let him. So we've got to push him, but we've also got to keep him in our prayers, it seems to me, because it's as hard a job as I can imagine.
Last thing for me, Bill McKibben, our prior guest was the governor of Massachusetts. And when he heard Marjorie say that Bill McKibben was coming next, he said during the break, I didn't get his exact words, please ask Bill about this. I think the gist of his question was, how big a deal was it that we were the first state in the country about a month ago to have a commercial offshore wind park approved, I think it's roughly 15 miles south of the Vineyard. It is a huge deal, isn't it?
It's a big deal. Yes. I mean, look, if you look at it in the biggest possible sense, our job over the next decade is to stop burning things on this planet and to take advantage instead of the fact that there is a huge ball of flame 90 million miles away. We can make use of that with solar panels, and we make use of that with wind turbines. The wind blows because the sun heats different parts of the planet differently at different moments, and the heat, the temperature differential drives the breeze, and that in turn can power our lives. And so it's, you know, we're, America is miles and miles, kilometers and kilometers behind the Europeans in developing offshore wind, but man, we better go at it hard and fast right now. Because what other choice do we have? I mean, especially in Massachusetts, you know, people go to the Cape in the summer for a beach vacation, but sunlight is not, you know, New England's single greatest strength, but man, oh man, we got plenty of wind.
You know, Bill McKibben, you know, lots of us get discouraged about a lot of what's going on in the United States of America. And I'm wondering if you are encouraged by these things. We just mentioned that the offshore wind thing, that people seem to be pretty enthusiastic about these electric Ford cars, you know, given a few caveats that General Motors says, I mean, I don't know if they will, but they say they're going to have nothing but electric by 2013, as you pointed out, 2035, excuse me, like you said in one of your pieces. So does it seem like the tide is turning to you? I know there's a lot of opposition at the same time, but
Marjorie, I think the zeitgeist has shifted. I think people's sense of what's normal and natural and obvious is finally shifting. And that's because of great organizing, and it's because Mother Nature keeps hitting us upside the head with the 2x4, you know?
Yeah.
Every new firestorm and whatever. So in that sense, you know, we've done our work in certain ways. But our problem is just that it all has to happen so fast.
Yeah.
And human institutions are not geared for speed, as you know. It's easier to prevent change than to make change. And the vested interests like the fossil fuel industries are past masters at preventing change. So we've got to keep pushing and keep pushing hard. And the story will, you know, rely in large part on how much human power we're able to bring to this fight. And, you know, on we go. What can you say?
I can say the following, that I know I speak for Marjorie. If we had a choice between the 2-minute version of Bill McKibben that we had on Tuesday and the 20-minute version today,
yeah,
we prefer the 20-minute version.
Absolutely.
Bill, keep that in mind, will you, please?
Good fun to talk, y'all. Take
great
care.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bill McKibben. Bill McKibben is a contributing writer of The New Yorker, where he writes these great pieces. You're going to check them out because it's stuff that I think most of us have no idea is even going on. He's a founder of 350.org and the Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College. His latest book is Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? He also writes The Climate Crisis. That's the New Yorker newsletter on the environment. Thanks again to Bill McKibben. Coming up, the culture wars come to the classroom. Paul Bravo joins us to talk about the GOP's fixation with critical race theory and other education headlines. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here to answer the same question we asked Governor Baker, summer school versus fun, and a variety of other things about the texting crisis, or at least the crisis it produced in the Boston School Committee, and the changing rules, the dramatically changing rules for admission to vocational schools in the state. Is Paul Revel. Paul, of course, is a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. He runs the Education Redesign Lab there, as well as latest book, co-authored with Lynn Sachs, is Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, a practical guide for school and community leaders. Yet another in-person guest. Paul, it is great to see you.
So nice to see your glowing faces
I
in
know,
person here.
I know. It's great.
I think it's one glowing face, but it's good to see you, too, anyway.
No, they're two. It's definitely two.
So, Paul Revel, as Jim just said, we were like big on summer school. Thought it was a great idea because kids will have missed so much. And then there was a Globe editorial that said, you know, come on, let everybody have some fun this summer because it's been so tense for these kids and they've been so depressed. A lot of them are just feeling miserable. Baker's talking about spending money on both, you know, is giving $70 million to summer programs as well as recreational programs. So where should we be this summer?
Well, you know, I wrote a piece in the Globe myself on the same topic. And what I was complaining about really was that we're drawing an artificial distinction between learning and fun. And as people who go to summer camp and all kinds of enrichment programs involving the arts or sports or other things know, I mean, it's quite possible and indeed desirable to blend the two together. And so I think if we view the problem that students have missed opportunities to learn over the past year and a half, which they clearly have, as just a technical problem. In other words, there's an absence of learning and we've got to pour some high quality cream into their heads so that they get up to speed. I think we're missing the boat. I mean, undeniably, there's been learning loss, but at the same time, students are alienated. Students are disconnected, and we need to reconnect them. We need to rebuild relationships. We need to rebuild inspiration and motivation. We need to get students reengaged. And I think enrichment programs that can include some component of learning, even academic learning, are the way to go. So if a lot of school systems are saying, we want to do summer school this summer, and they're finding out parents and kids aren't that, and teachers for that matter, aren't that interested. But if you advertise it as summer enrichment, where we're going to do some outdoor activities, we're going to get people out running around, exercising, you know what people do in summer camps and these kinds of things, and there's going to be a learning component to it, too, I think you get there. So it's not an either or.
Can we talk about the learning component for a second? I think the governor told us, I can't remember the number because it was so long ago, it was a half hour ago, I think something like $70 million for school districts for summer learning and recreational programs. I'm not reading a huge amount about what the actual plans are for local communities on the summer school front. Is the planning at a stage that makes people like you content that this is not back of the envelope because there's been so much other crap that they have to deal with?
Well, I mean, I'm not privy to all the plans. What I hear anecdotally is a lot of kind of defaulting to the way we always have thought about summer school as kind of a remedial activity where we do in the summer what we do in the regular year. And I'm also seeing from parents and students and teachers, a kind of dissatisfaction with that. They don't want to do that. That is not drawing people in. School systems are finding it hard to get teachers to teach in summer school. And there's a lot of resistance to doing it from people in the field. So I think we need to sort of repackage what we're doing and say it's not, you know, we're not going to line you up at desks and do drill and kill during the summer to get you reengaged in learning. That would be the opposite way of getting people sort of sympathetically approaching the relationships that go into learning. So we've got to be more imaginative and creative in doing it. I think programs like Boston After School and Beyond, which is supporting a broad network of different kinds of organizations that offer recreational and learning opportunities around the city and trying to make those available to as many students as possible, I think that's the way to go.
You know, I've been reading, and I saw on TV last night as well, Paul Revel, stories about these furious fights at school boards and in individual school districts around the country. I haven't heard of any here. People all upset about their teaching critical race theory in kindergarten through 12, which I don't think anybody's doing. It was kind of like they thought people were doing this and they were going bananas. But the Republican Party seems to be pretty wrapped up with critical race theory. they even had the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, arguing with the congressman from Florida, Matt Gaetz, about what they were doing, even looking at this in the military. And I thought Milley pushed back very effectively. But what is up with critical race theory in the schools?
Well, I mean, as you know, the Republicans are very effective at igniting cultural brush fires and fanning those flames into cultural wars. And so they've taken a term here, which is a very broad and complex and largely academic term to describe systemic features of racism that are embodied in policy or embodied in regulations or embodied just in institutions and values in our culture, and the discussion of that and trying to identify them and then do something about them, paint it with a very broad brush and mischaracterize it as a kind of a racial war where one group is saying the other group is bad and this group is superior, which, of course, nobody is saying, and tarring the whole notion of discussing matters of race, which have moved to the forefront in our national conversation ever since the George Floyd incident and many like it that have precipitated a long overdue discussion. And people want to ban that discussion because they're uncomfortable with concepts like white supremacy or white fragility or a number of these things about which reasonable people can disagree, you know, and have a discussion. And it's a democracy, and we want eventually our students to be able to engage with this. We don't need to propagate or impose beliefs on kids in K-12 schools, but we need to get them to understand that there are racial issues that are an important part of our history and somehow to be able to engage in intelligent, thoughtful conversations on that topic. So some of the states have gone overboard in just outlawing any discussion whatsoever of race in classrooms or any view of history that would construe one group of people did something wrong to another group of people. I mean, there's an attempt to just abolish the discussion altogether, which I think is a free speech issue.
Well, not only abolish the whole discussion, I don't want to spend too much time on this because I'm in a fairly good mood and it's going to aggravate me. When you listen to legislators who are advancing these things on television, whether it's in a state legislature or it's a school committee person locally or a federal legislator, I feel confident in saying they have no idea what the hell they're talking about. Almost every single one of them says essentially what they're teaching is all of us white people are racist. But right. In fact, as you say, it's about the whole notion of racism not just being the product of individual bias or individual prejudice, but rather it's embedded in legal and other systems. Why is that such a scary notion? And if it turns out you want to respond to it in a classroom saying, I don't buy that, then so be it. But it is so clearly, as you say, a misdirection play.
Well, I mean, that's
it's insane.
It's fear mongering. And so it's easy to get people fearful in the current climate that we're in for a variety of reasons, including some things that I heard the governor commenting on before. When we're anonymous, when we're at a distance from one another, when we're not face-to-face and engaged, it's easy to develop stereotypes and negative perceptions and then feed those and grow those. And that's what a lot of our news organizations do these days. You know, so it goes on Fox News and various sort of untruths, shibboleths about what critical race theory is all about. Those flames get fanned and then people get scared and they reacting to the headlines, but they don't know
exactly
any of the
right.
nuance
exactly.
of the story. It's the same thing with transgender youth in sports. You know, you're elevating this out or the bathrooms that we had the bathroom problem.
How about stolen elections? Similar,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know something, before we leave this, you're an educator. Explain to people what critical race theory is.
I just did, didn't I?
Yeah, well,
did you?
Yeah, I think I did, but go ahead, you do better.
No, well, I mean, again, it's an academic it was a concept for doing analysis of the way in which policy, regulation, think of redlining, of the laws that were built into various housing policies and grants for federal aid with respect to housing and housing development in the urban context and how it isolated certain populations in particular neighborhoods. So it's looking at...
We should explain redlining. Banks wouldn't give loans to whole swaths, whole neighborhoods. It just happened to be African-American.
Right. But, you know, it just seems to me if you were talking about that history, the history of racism that has been with us, you know, from slavery to Jim Crow to post-Jim Crow with the redlining stuff that, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote about so effectively in the Atlantic a few years ago, that a lot of the stuff that, again, a lot of us didn't know. And children learned about this. To me, this would be a good thing because you would understand what African Americans have had to put up with for so long in this country, and there'd be more empathy from people who don't have much empathy now because they're ignorant of these facts.
Yeah, and well-educated people. I was at a cocktail party recently and had somebody who's very well-educated, advanced degrees from Ivy League schools, say to me, well, you know, we were talking about things like affirmative action or having to bend over backwards to provide, you know, certain opportunities to certain kinds of people. He said, well, you know, it's been, how long has it been since the Civil War? I mean, isn't this over now? And you know, no awareness of Jim Crow, no awareness of all these other policies and practices and what the day-to-day life is. All you have to do is pick up a paper and see, you know, if a white person asks for an assessment evaluation of a house, she's going to get a higher value than if a black person asks it. So it's embedded.
Yeah.
And we don't see it because we're, you know, we benefit from the privilege and we're in kind of homogenized groups, many of us. And holding that up and saying that's there and we need to deal with it. We didn't cause it necessarily, but we may be involved in perpetuating it and we should at least be talking about it. That's really important. And Republicans don't want to have that conversation.
We're talking to Paul Revel, former Secretary of Education now at Harvard, who obviously is spending a lot of time
at cocktail parties. And you're going to say that,
okay,
Jim.
So,
Paul and I were at a cocktail party.
I don't drink, by the way.
I know. I was not able to go to.
I'm a teetotaler, so I don't drink. So I'm not there for the alcohol.
Okay.
So
for the free food, I'm assuming.
I must admit.
Let's not get into that for a variety
and a margarita.
Of reasons.
Yeah.
So vocational, through the years that we've been talking to you, we've talked a lot about the importance of vocational schools and all the problems in terms of, well, a ton of problems. Now there is a pretty radical decision made by our state to essentially drop grade requirements, attendance requirements, not consider disciplinary issues to allow a more diverse group of people to get into these schools that can be their lifeline, needless to say.
Right.
Was this a good move?
I think it is a good move. I wouldn't describe it, however, Jim, as a radical move. I think a more radical move would have been to specify a set of criteria that apply across the board to all the vocational districts as they consider admissions. What they did do at the state level, and I applaud their courage in doing it, was to say that, you know, the previously specified criteria that you must look at are going to be relaxed and each local district can come up with its own criteria. And then the local school boards get to review those criteria and that the Department of Elementary and Secondary has some oversight about that. So
you think they should have mandated it statewide? Is that what you're saying?
There are a number of groups, and I have some sympathy with them, who would have liked more assurance that the changes in admissions policy are going to lead to a more balanced admission situation. In other words, vocational schools, it's ironic because vocational schools were once thought of, quote unquote, as dumping grounds, you know, of places where the poorest performing students ought to be shoved to learn a trade so they could get out there. And in recent years, in the past 20 years, again, ironically, because those schools originally thought standards shouldn't apply to them in the standards-based school reform movement, it's one of the great victories of standards-based reform in Massachusetts in the 1993 Act is those schools have done remarkably well in getting their students to advanced and proficient status, getting their students onto college. They perform on average better on MCAS than the comprehensive high schools in the and they become more competitive to get to. And as they become more competitive, they're now less and less serving the populations that they originally served who were not being well served back in their comprehensive high schools and want admissions to these schools and haven't had an opportunity to get in. And so this is an opportunity to rectify the imbalance in admissions and also to increase the pipeline. One of the features in this set of changes that's important but less recognized than the admissions criteria is forcing the feeder schools to provide tours to the vocational vocational schools. So the pool of kids who are interested in going to vocational schools increases because a lot of the schools' systems don't want their students going to the voc schools. So they don't advertise the option that you have a vocational school option to go to because they'll lose money, which follows the students. So in general, I would say overall, this is a great step in the right direction. I hope the department watches over the changes in admissions criteria closely so that we don't just preserve the status quo, but we really do see some change.
So you never know when a cheerleader case is going to make it to the Supreme Court, but indeed it did.
Yes.
And the Supreme Court just decided yesterday this Pennsylvania cheerleader who didn't make the cheerleading squad and went on this expletive-laced rant on Snapchat and got dumped off the squad. The Supreme Court sided with her, and the Washington Post characterized this as a rare win for student speech on free speech matters and said that they're with the cheerleader.
Yeah, no, it was a surprisingly high level of consensus. I mean, I think it was 8-1.
Yep,
Thomas, of course.
Of course.
Apparently
we all say the exact same moment. Go ahead.
He didn't make the cheerleading squad either, I don't think.
No.
But you did, as we know.
Nor does he have a squad cheering for him, as far as I can see. But he apparently believes students have no free speech rights. But there's a remarkable consensus in the public public about this. In fact, Republicans are more in favor of this decision than Democrats are. And overall, I saw in the Times this morning, 71% of people in the public support the notion that schools can't discipline students for off campus comments.
That's because Republicans are much more foul mouthed than Democrats.
Well, that may be, Jim. Right.
But it is
interesting. I mean, from a school standpoint, this is a very gray area because you take another topic, bullying.
Yes.
We know a lot of bullying happens offline, out of school hours, on the internet, and has profound effects in school, where kids gang up and they all attack somebody via social media. And
Phoebe Prince in South Hadley, one of the most egregious cases not so long ago.
So schools have been struggling with where are the borders on free speech? I mean, is it the place of the school? Is it the school hours? Is it the subject? In this case, she didn't name the school. She didn't name anybody in the school. That was thought to be relevant. And the court allowed in its decision that there are instances in which schools can intervene in off-campus speech, but they have a heavy burden of proof to show there. That in general, the default ought to be to parents for disciplining students for their behavior outside of school, not to schools.
Okay, so you're still the Secretary of Education today, as opposed to the past Paul Revel. You have to write a memo to each of the school committees in the state and the superintendents saying what the line is. How do you describe what they can discipline kids for outside of school and what they can't?
Well, I mean, number one, I go to my legal counsel to try.
Okay, fine. He or she is not here, so we're asking.
Right. I mean, I think that it's got to be something that that has an immediate effect on people involved in the schools. In other words, if it in some way disrupts the process of education for any individual or for the institution, then there seems to be a pretext or a basis for taking some disciplinary action. If it is just expression of a viewpoint that on any range of subjects, some of which might involve the school, but only indirectly, I think you've got to allow that to proceed.
Talking to Paul Revel.
But I think we're on a journey to clarify this, and it's very difficult in this internet world that we live in to define such sharp boundaries.
You know, before you go, Marjorie just mentioned, I think you're reading from the Washington Post, some legal observer, this is a horrible way to describe it, in the Washington Post, but it sounded like a credible person, said this is the first case in decades, did they say, where the Supreme Court came down on the side of
very
student
rare,
speech.
Very rare for them to do this.
And so was this seen, to use the word radical, as a radical departure for the court, or
I think there was a lot of surprise in the field that it was, that there was this much agreement on it, and but there are very particular circumstances here as well. And as I say, the court has allowed schools in the future to intervene in off-campus speech, but they've said there's a heavy burden of proof And I think the factors are going to be disruption.
Now, before you go, or just a little quiz, which we haven't done in a while. If you had to guess, one of the two of us was the co-head of the cheerleading squad. Can I finish a sentence,
please?
A
million years ago.
I may have been, but I was trying to get a question out to the former Secretary of Education, since he would know about such things. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he oversaw cheerleading.
Yeah.
One of the two of us was the co-something, whatever it's called, head of the cheerleading squad. Captain, thank you. At his or her high school. Who would you guess that was? You have 10 seconds to answer, Paul Revan.
Well, go ahead. Jim, you're such an enthusiastic person, I'd have to go with you.
That is correct, of course.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's right. He can really do incredible cartwheels, let me tell you.
Marjorie Fagan was the co-chair of the damn cheerleading squad at Durfee
My
High
finest hour, Paul.
In Fall River, Massachusetts.
That's all I ever wanted to be.
Well, honestly, I have an easier, much easier time imagining that than I do you.
So do
being
doing
at the top
split.
Of one of those pyramids and then diving into the trampoline.
That's right.
That our kids are holding. That could be dangerous.
Oh, man.
That could be dangerous.
Paul, it's great to see you. We're glad you came in.
Great to see both of you.
Thank you very much. Paul Revel, love to talk to you, Paul. And we had a wonderful time at the cocktail party, Jim, where you didn't get to go.
Okay, fine.
By the way, I was
invited. Let's be clear, because it makes it sound even worse. I could not go to the unnamed cocktail party.
To do, Marge.
That's
well,
right. He did. He's a very important man.
Okay, fine. Goodbye.
All over America.
Nice to see you, Paul.
Enjoy the beautiful weather.
Thank you.
Paul Revel is the former State Secretary of Education, professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Lynn Sachs, Collaborative Action for Equity and Opportunity, a Practical Guide for School and Community Leaders. Great to see Paul Revel again in person. Coming up, during COVID, a company gave up its office space. Now their employees are working, get this, from restaurants.
I love this story.
If GBH traded in its office to, say, the Whole Foods Hot Bar, would Jim want to come back to work? Imagine that, Jim. Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young joins us for that and other business headlines. You're listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Join us online to go over the latest business headlines as Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young. Shirley, of course, is also a GBH contributor. Hey there, Shirley.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hey,
Shirley. Great to talk to you. So we've been talking a lot today about sales tax. We talked about it with the governor. We talked about it with our listeners, this idea that we're going to have a sales tax holiday for August and September. What's your take on this?
I think this is one of the worst ideas ever. Why are we doing this?
Okay.
There actually is one reason, right? Mm-hmm. Does this mean the governor is thinking about a third term? Is seriously going to run? Is going to run for a third term? I mean, this is the only reason why you would do it, right?
Well, you know, I thought it was kind of, I'm embarrassed to say now, since you just trashed it, Shirley, I kind of thought it was a fun thing, since everybody's had kind of a tough year. You know, you could
$900 million fun thing.
New refrigerator, or you could go out and get your new Sleep Number bed or something like that with a 6%.
So, Shirley, are you invest the money instead? Is that where you are?
Well, yes, but before we get to that, you know, Marty, it is so hard to buy a refrigerator. It is so hard to buy an appliance right now. The pandemic has disrupted the supply chain. So if you imagine, we're about to supercharge, if this goes through, we're going to supercharge consumer buying in Massachusetts. But it's hard to get a lot of certain products already. And also, the pandemic has upended the labor market, especially at the retail level. I mean, you won't even have people, you don't have people to stock the shelves to run the cash register. So I just, it just doesn't seem like, it doesn't even seem logical to encourage more spending when I don't think the small businesses can handle the current demand. And Jim, I'm sorry, but yes, I think $900 million, there are so many other ways you can spend the $900 million rather than a short-term fix. You know, why not invest that in improving the T, in subsidizing childcare, in doing more, I mean, give out more grants to small businesses if you want to help them that way.
So what's your sense of where the legislature comes on this? A handful of Democrats have said, as many of our listeners and emailers did, invest it. Don't give a 6% discount on products. What are the Democrats do? With very few exceptions, they've been a pretty compliant group when it comes to Governor Baker. What do they do here?
I think they should fight it. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me, really, unless the governor's, you know, the governor's, it is a very, it grabs a lot of headlines. It feels good. And especially if you're going to run for a third term. Right. But I think in terms of if you really want to improve the economy long term, make some of those investments. I mean, think about it. We've long complained we don't have enough money. Right. The state, we don't have enough money for this. We don't have money for that. Suddenly we have a lot of money. And so let's double the investment on education. I know we're already, you know, putting a lot of money into education, but, you know, our kids, K through 12 kids, I mean, they suffered a lot during the pandemic. Could we need more to get them back on track? Because so many of them were studying remotely for so long.
Obviously, Shirley does not need a new refrigerator. That's the bottom line. We're talking to Shirley. No, I'm only kidding. We're talking to Shirley the Young. Shirley, I don't know if you heard, Marjorie teased your segment about this business. I love the story in your paper about a business deciding to essentially give up their physical premises. And when they do convene their employees, they convene them at restaurants, nightclubs, that sort of thing. Because cleverly, I never even thought of this, most of these places don't even open till nighttime. So it's extra money for a business that's been suffering. I think this is beyond brilliant. What's your take on this?
I think so this is a Boston, a tech company. I think it's called Modus.
Yeah.
My colleague Anissa Gardizi wrote about it, and they want to, during the daytime, they will meet at a restaurant. Right. I don't know. I think it might be fun the first time, the second time, and the third time it might start to get strange. Right. You're in a restaurant. I think it might be hard to, I think the novelty will wear off very quickly working in a restaurant. I don't know. It's kind of like the novelty of working at home full time. Right. After a while, you're like, I just want to get out of my house and go to an office and work and see my colleagues. At some point you're going to be like, it does feel like we're working in a restaurant.
Right? I have to say, I disagree with you. I think the notion, if you're going to have a hybrid world, the notion of some creativity, doing things in different places. And by the way, let me be clear to the listeners again. The restaurants are obviously closed to other business. People come early in the day. They set up their computers, the tables, as some of the employees said, are like a desk, sort of like what they said, sort of like what desks used to look like a long time ago. And I thought it was yet another creative way to look at returning to work. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think one of the things that obviously, and we've talked about this with you, Shirley, is the cost of office space. You know, that a lot of people are just saying to themselves, why am I renting this?
Well, that's what these people are obviously saying too.
This massive amount of office space, and why am I doing this when we've shown how successfully we can work at home, but we don't want to be working there all the time. So it's kind of a pop-up deal where they'll do it like,
it's exactly what it is,
every few months or something like that.
Still nothing? Yeah. It was still against?
No. I guess I can't see doing this every week, right?
Right.
Maybe once a quarter, right? There are efforts to create co-working spaces in the suburbs, you know, outside the downtown districts, where people working from home then can meet their colleagues in alternative spaces, right? Spaces other than their normal workplaces. I do like that idea. I guess I just don't see, every week we're going to a restaurant. I don't know. Maybe it's a special, because I guess we'll say, I also value boundaries. You know, I want restaurants to, I don't want to go
restaurants.
To this restaurant and think about work.
That's a pretty good point. That is your most compelling point. That is a good one.
I mean, that's what I think about my home. It's like when I'm home, I want to relax. And now I can't relax completely in my home because I'm working from home all the time.
You know,
so same thing with the restaurants. You know, I want some boundaries in life.
But Shirley, you know, when you combine this company, which, by the way, is the exception, not the rule. Most companies are not doing this. With another story we talked about the other day, it was also in your paper, that 40% of workers will not be back to work, even hybrid, till January. That's up from 20% just a month or so ago. Same question we've asked you every several weeks. What is the expectation of what's going to happen to the real business real estate market in places like Boston and the small businesses you've written about when you walk down Newbury Street that are dependent upon the Pru being full?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a whole new world. Even if it's only 20% less, doesn't have to be huge, even 10% less trickles down to almost everybody, including all the small businesses in the neighborhood.
I mean, we need a plan. I mean, whether it's the downtown districts or the city of Boston, there needs to be a plan to support these businesses. I mean, I've been starting to think about this because we talk about this every week, right? What about downtown businesses? And, you know, it could be as simple as when we do return to in-person work, making sure that that the employers who are in the office make sure you do lunch, you cater lunch, right? Organize lunch so that when everyone's there's big lunch orders, right? For these local restaurants, something that there's intentionality behind how do we support the downtown? How do we give them more business now that we're here? We don't leave it up to our workers stepping outside. You know, what can employers do on a, you know, broader, you know, bigger basis to help these small businesses?
Well, you know, John Chesto had a very interesting story about a lot of businesses aren't going to be returning to travel like they did beforehand. And he has some statistics that weekday hotel bookings around here are a quarter of what they were in 2019. Logan is now half what it was. And, you know, so you worry about
in terms of air travelers kind of thing?
Yes, yeah. In terms of air travelers. And it says less than 10% of total travel. I'm goofing that up. The point is that business travel is going to be dramatically down. And I feel bad for the hotels and I guess workers at Logan. On the other hand, think about how much better these people's lives can be not having to fly, as this story says, to California for an hour-long meeting or something. You can
not bad for the environment either.
And exactly, all that jet flying around. So I think this is another one of the good things to come out of this mess. People
are
jet lagged.
Yeah, and another change. And another permanent change, right, from about the way we do business. I mean, also there's cost savings too, right? The companies are going to be saving a lot of money on travel and entertainment. And you're absolutely right. A lot of these CEOs and a lot of top executives who used to fly to Europe or Asia every week, they don't want to do it. They want to see their families more. And if they can be just as effective virtually, they're going to try to stay home when they can.
You know, the number I botched was that business travel at Logan used to be 40% of total traffic. Now it's less than 10% of total traffic. That's a big change.
It is. I mean, a lot of the forecast is that the leisure travel will be, you know, busier, stronger and on its way back more than business travel. And that will lag for some time. You know, I feel bad for the hotels, but maybe the hotels can then try to shift to leisure travelers. You know, people do still want a vacation.
Yeah. And you think of really the prices are so expensive at a lot of Boston hotels, too. I mean, unless you're expensing it, how many people can really afford it?
Well, I assume they're going to have to cut those prices, right, when occupancy rates are low. We're talking to Shirley Young. Shirley, I have to say some of the most compelling stories I've read in the Globe of late. Janelle Nanos, I think, did the first one about essentially a revolution in the craft beer industry. And this woman, Brienne Allen, who I guess started this whole thing from Notch Brewing, tell the story how essentially Me Too is coming to craft brewing.
Right. This is the second of a series of stories that Janelle's written about the women in craft beer industry. You know, they're posting on social media their experiences, and it's gone global. And executives have stepped down. Her latest story was focused on Wormtown Brewery
Worcester.
And what's happening there. You know, I think what was really surprising to me was some of the women who were speaking out saying that when they talked about, alleged sexual harassment and discrimination, gender discrimination, at these breweries, that they got, there was a lot of backlash. And they got, because if you think about when we were writing about the Me Too reckoning from a few years ago, by and large, a lot of companies changed, right? People, people, CEOs lost their jobs, boards were turned over. And you find out in the craft brewery industry, they that didn't happen there. And it's some of that is only just happening now, a few years later. And so I give a lot of credit to these women to speak out now. But some of the stories are incredible, racist and sexist comments, to workers and to managers there.
Boys Club on steroids. I mean, it's just, I was going to say it's amazing. It's not so surprising or amazing, but it's horrible, actually, and good for these women for standing up. We're talking to Shirley DeYoung from the Boston Globe.
So, Shirley DeYoung, your colleagues Matt Stout and Tim Logan have a piece about this group of pro-development people are putting together a lot of money to try to influence the mayoral race, and they want housing, of course, is a major issue in the mayoral race. So is this good? Is this bad? What should we think about this?
Well, one of the groups is called the Responsible Development Coalition. And, it sounds a little, right? You're like, is it possible to have responsible development, right? And often it almost sounds like an oxymoron, right? They're calling for development can be good. We want to make sure that people are paid well, the workers are paid well. We want to make sure there's affordable housing. I don't think that a lot of the candidates have, support issues like that, support platforms like that. And so it'll be very interesting how this shakes out. And I think some of them might endorse, some of them might not endorse. So they could, in a very tight mayoral race, these type of groups can make a difference in the race. I think their own polls. So one of the coalition's polls said that affordable housing is one of the top issues that voters care about. How do we make housing more affordable in the city of Boston?
Yeah, I have to say, I didn't get this whole thing, or maybe I'm just missing. I heard one of the commercials on some radio station this morning as I was flipping through. It was the voice was the head of the Carpenters Union, I think, of New England, on behalf of this responsible development thing. I assume what under the surface is we're concerned that there are a lot of progressives running for mayor. We're worried they're going to get on an anti-development platform. So we want to give them a heads up in advance that if they're looking for support from us, like Marty Walsh had in what's likely to be a close race, don't close the door on development as much as you otherwise might have. Isn't that your takeaway, Shirley?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely want to. They don't want to. If you think about it, the unions, the construction unions, developers, they've had it good, right, under the last mayor, Mayor Walsh, who came from the labor
building trades, right.
And so they want that to continue. And so they are trying to influence parts of this election. But the time is very different now when times are incredibly different when Marty Walsh ran in 2013. I mean, there is a lot of attention, really a focus on equity. How do we build a more equitable Boston? And so those progressive forces are being embraced like never before.
Well, you know what it seems to me, just looking around, I mean, where we are here in Brighton has become like this mecca of these high rises.
Well, Guest Street alone, where we're located.
That are really, really expensive. So I'm not clear if these people are talking about, maybe you don't make as much money building affordable housing. I don't know, but you look at Fenway, these huge, I don't know if it's retail or if it's apartments or what it is. It's like the city has changed so fast, so dramatically with really high-end housing. I mean, you just don't see the same, when you drive through Dorchester, you drive through Roxbury, you drive through Mattapan, you don't see this dramatic, all these cranes everywhere putting up affordable housing. So it seems to be tilted toward high end as opposed to affordable.
It is. That's what investors will finance, right?
Yeah.
It's very expensive to build in the city of Boston. They're looking at the market. You know, if we, you know, if we build something, who you know, it costs so much to build in Boston that it almost defaults to luxury housing.
By the way, I have some bad news for you. I just got a message that the Boston Globe staff will be meeting at Davio's tomorrow. So I guess you won't be able to go. What can I say, Shirley?
I think you should meet in a roof deck somewhere. That would be good. You know, make sure they have umbrellas because it's going to be so hot. But, you know, I wouldn't mind that, right?
I just want a plain old – I just want a traditional office environment. You know, I crave that once or twice a week where I'm not making phone calls and doing laundry and batting away little kids. That's not too much to ask for, is it?
It's
and then when I go
not.
To a restaurant, I don't want to think about work. I just want something to eat and something to drink.
Fair enough. Got it. Shirley, it's great to talk to you.
It's an excellent point, Shirley, as always.
Be well.
Hey.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. That was Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young. She joins us every week. She's also a GBH contributor. Thanks again for joining
us. Don't you like that idea? I mean,
I kind of do, actually.
Even though Shirley's points are good about separating the joy of a restaurant from working in a restaurant, I think that creative, different
Although,
thing.
Aren't
everyone's
you eating in a restaurant usually? Do you not
do you eat?
Eat?
What are we doing while we're working?
Well, we're shoving food in. We're
exactly.
But that's different than being in a restaurant where you want to enjoy your meal.
That's Shirley's point, I guess.
Okay.
In any case.
Coming up, we're going to go back to what we were talking about before because why not? We're sales tax obsessed today.
We are.
I'm going to ask you again about the sales tax holiday. Shirley thinks it's a terrible idea to expand it from 2 days to the entire month of August, September. A lousy idea. A lot of people do. Governor Baker likes it. I like it. But convince me otherwise. Weigh in on that. 877-301-8970. WGBH. Whoops, BPR at WGBH.org is the email. I'm having a momentary. BPR at WGBH.org. That is the email, isn't
it? That's pretty close, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Okay. And you can tweet us at Boston Public Radio. You are listening to Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. Marjorie said, we're going to end where we began. Well, we began with Chuck Todd. We almost began with a sales tax discussion. Yesterday, Governor Baker announced that the usual two-day sales tax holiday, which happens sometime in August virtually every year, he would like to see become a two-month August and September sales tax holiday. He defended it when he was with us at 12 o'clock. Delonte had a great idea, a caller, right before the governor got here. And the governor said he found it quite interesting. If you're going to do it, target it to small businesses. Delonte said with fewer than 30 employees, some number, so it doesn't go to the big box stores. It goes to local neighborhood small businesses. The governor seemed to like that idea. He said if the mechanics could work out. But a lot of people like Shirley Leung, and this is my old self, I'm sort of a compromiser this time. Don't like the idea at all. Think it's just a campaign stunt, a waste of money. Marjorie, of course, wants to save 6% on a pillow or something and whatever. 877-301-8970. A lot of our emailers and callers said they'd prefer to see the money invested. It's close to $900 million in lost sales tax revenues, according to the governor in his announcement yesterday. We want to know one more time, after having heard from Shirley and the governor and other callers, where are you in this? 877-301-8970.
Well, you were sort of with me when we started this. Have you changed your mind
now? I was in the middle. I've historically been 100% against this. I am for a splitting the baby kind of thing. Spend $500-600 million on things we need. And if you wanted to spend a couple of $100 million, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever, it's not so much because I'm convinced, because I'm not, that it helps the economy. It's because I'm sort of buying into what you have been people deserve some fun. And if a little savings on something that they're going to buy is going to make their shopping experience a little better, I know it's expensive, but this comes after a very strange 15 months. So I'm usually not compromising on the issue. This time I am. Charlene in a car, you're first this time on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Charlene.
Thank you. I'm totally against this. I don't think that we deserve a little fun. I think what we deserve is to give residential treatment centers and hospital beds to children and adolescents that have been in crisis. And $900 million could go quite far in having, you know, the care that children, adolescents, and even people obviously struggling with drug addictions could benefit from. And then that is like something that will carry on for generations if you can turn these kids around and save them now. $68 savings on my $1,000 refrigerator isn't going to make a difference in my life long term, but really making a difference with this population will carry on.
Well, Charlene, I want you to tell you, in all candor, you've totally humiliated me, and I appreciate your call. That's really powerful argument.
Charlene, you're right. But you could also say that we are desperate for places for people to live, and people don't have a place to live. And we're desperate for people to get their dialysis drugs.
All the more reason to spend it rather than do a tax
break. People are desperate for a lot of things. And you're right. I mean, I look ridiculous saying, oh, well, you can save $68 in your refrigerator, whatever it is, as opposed to that. But I guess my thing is that we rarely give something back in terms of money, you know, in the state
of
Massachusetts.
Well, services, Charlene would argue, is giving something back.
All these services are more important,
exactly.
Right? We should give more money to the schools. We should give more money to this. We should be giving more money to millions of things. People don't like to raise taxes, but you know, you're right. I mean, on the merits, you're right. I guess I'm maybe more frivolous. Something.
Charlene, that was a great call. Thank you for making it. 877-301-8897. I would have to say, if our listeners were the decision makers in this, mm-hmm. based on our several conversations with them today, they're not crazy about having no sales tax for 2 months.
I think I'm getting pummeled.
Well, also, I can't believe, why did I take a compromise position? I'm being humiliated too. My old rigid self would have been far more comfortable. Joe in Boston, you're kind to call. Welcome. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. My point is with the sales tax during the summer, there are a lot of tourists here. Why should they get a break? And if he wants to rebate the money, just rebate it according to what people paid in their taxes.
That's an interesting thought, too, Joe. Thank you for the call. I would assume the same rules, not that anybody complies with them, apply when you buy something tax-free in New Hampshire. If the same product is taxed here, theoretically, you're supposed to pay the tax. I think you add it to your income tax. I may be wrong, but I assume most people don't do that.
Tourists are going to be buying refrigerators on their vacation.
Well, you never know. I mean, you buy a refrigerator, you put it in the what do you call that rack above? I haven't flown in so long. It's unbelievable.
Yeah,
the overhead rack.
Yeah, that's right. Eric from Marblehead.
You know, by the way, these people, though, like Charlene are saying what they're saying. I mean, again, this is my old self. The savings is so small. It is incredible. Of course, I assume Baker would say, as he did say at 12, it's not such an insignificant thing for the small business owner who's had a really tough 15 months, and August is a slow sales time.
In defense of what people obviously think is a ridiculous position, which is mine,
yes.
that there was that one person that called up and did talk about the retail stores and how much of a big deal this is to retail stores, especially little retail stores that nobody wanted to go into because you're so close to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you go into a big box store, obviously it's not such a big deal. It could spread out.
Yeah, but the point that Delonte was saying, who cares about helping big box stores? The goal is to help small neighborhood businesses.
Well, he had the best point to say it should be smaller businesses.
Yeah, and the governor seemed to be open to it, at least so it appears. Eric in Marblehead, what's up?
Hi, first time, long time.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Taking the call.
Thank you.
You guys are outstanding.
Thank
You're
you.
Welcome. Very complex issue. It's a consumption-based tax, obviously. And we're a commonwealth. My thought is that it's going to create asymmetries. Governor Baker has done a fantastic job, does a lot of analysis, and probably has thought this thing through. But I just think that we accumulate these taxes for a purpose, and we should take some time to think about the implications of what we're doing to the commonwealth as a result of this. And the hard part is that I was going to say something exactly. I'm listening to you as you're talking, and I'm saying, man, those are great points, Jim and Marshall, you're making. So, it changes a little bit. One thing just popped out of my mind was, how about some kind of an incentive where maybe Massachusetts-based businesses or businesses that come to Massachusetts get a break or something like that, smaller businesses, that kind of thing, something that really invests in the Commonwealth.
Yeah.
And does it equally. So.
Yeah.
Thoughtful call as well, Eric. Thank you for your first, and we hope you make another one soon.
I think where a lot of people go to buy refrigerators are like Home Depot or Best Buy or something, too.
I
right?
would think so, even though there are neighborhood. Yeah,
stores.
That's true. So in light of the fact that you've been totally humiliated by
totally
the callers
humiliated.
And you're supportive of this, what would you guess, assuming the governor gets his way and there's 2 months? And by the way, we should have said, I think I said it earlier, if the governor, even if his plan is totally rejected by the legislature and it does need their approval, there'd still be 2 days. I think it's 22nd, 23rd, some days in August that were statutorily approved in the past. So that would be the minimum tax-free
Correct.
Holiday anyway. So what are you going to buy to save your 6 cents on the dollar? Nothing, right?
I'm thinking about it, Jim.
What are you contemplating buying, Marjorie? Everybody wants to know. She has no idea.
I have no idea.
No idea.
I have no idea. I did just buy a new refrigerator. So
you did?
Yes, I did.
Wow, how's
changed,
that going?
It's changed my whole life.
Yeah. Okay.
And I walk into the kitchen and I look at that refrigerator. I said, "This is." I'm
That's who I am.
I'm living the dream. Living the dream.
We're done.
My new refrigerator.
We're
okay.
Done.
Thank you very much for listening to Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by a woman who is running for governor, which is kind of exciting. Danielle Allen, she's a gubernatorial candidate, and the surgeon who saved Pepita the squirrel.
Oh, ready I cannot to hear about wait
that.
To meet
Plus,
this guy.
I'm going to talk to Senate President Karen Spilka, so she can probably trash the sales tax holiday as well. Spilka
she
said
can.
What she's doing about the So I'll be pummeled again tomorrow. Anyway, I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, Dave Goldstein, and Miles Smith, the engineers who run our remote studios. What's on TV, Jim? You're not on TV tonight.
Thank you. I'm not. Adam Riley has a great show, though. I'm embarrassed to say I forget what he has, but when I heard... No, I did. I'm being honest. What can I say? When I heard what he was doing, I thought it was terrific. Oh, he is actually doing something around this Me Too movement in the craft beer industry.
Oh,
I forgot
great.
About that. That's part of the thing. I was a little jealous because he's doing it, but I'm sure it's going to be great on a really important topic. That's an unusual Friday for us. That's a great lineup. I'm into that, by the way. We usually have all of our regulars and
yep.
that sort of thing, but we're doing, I guess, a variation on a theme. We'll spend another 2 or 3 hours on sales tax tomorrow, too. Why not? Spent almost the whole show today. Why not do it? That's what sports radio does. They discuss who the quarterback of the Patriots should be for like 4 years in a row or some such thing.
I know.
What can
they
I say?
They don't have 5 inches of reading every night.
I guess they don't. In
okay.
any case, I am, despite all that, I am still Jim Browdy.
I am still Marjorie Egan, and
yeah.
I still want to thank you for tuning in today.
I do too.
I hope you can tune in tomorrow. Hope you have a wonderful day. Anything else you'd like to say, Jim?
Bye.
Bye.